Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Simple and delicious, the new Southern-style chicken biscuit for breakfast and the Southern-style chicken sandwich for lunch or dinner. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
right, well, there you go. Pretty good stuff for you. Title track from the Black Sabbath album Paranoid and I Am Iron Man. A couple of big ones released back in January of 71 and recorded absolutely live in concert. Hey, listen, our program, Absolutely Live in Concert, was written, produced, and engineered by the biggest Black Sabbath fan of them all, Donnie Ray. Mixed by Dave Amaya, additional in-studio engineering by Mike Gagliano, courtesy of WRIF in Detroit. Live recordings by Westwood One Remote Recording, and engineered by Biff Dawes, assisted by Doug Fields, Phil Kneebone, and Jay Resnick. Special thanks to the quality control of the Koseo clan. Absolutely Live in Concert is a presentation of the almighty Westwood One. Your executive producer, the big man, Norm Pattis, and I'm the Doc, Doug Podell. Until next time, you guys remember to rock till you drop, and I'll see ya.
Axe Boost Shower Gel presents this highlight from the hookup future. Soon, Max Linderman will experience a tingling sensation in his brain, tongue, and underpants. Max immediately boards a bus to the Happy Times Chocolate Factory, arriving just as late-night worker Sonia spills cocoa on herself and screams for help to get it off.
Help.
Max is only too happy to oblige. Happenstance? No. New Axe Boost Shower Gel. Boost your extra sexual perception.
Stay, make the day a little better.
If you're on the road, there's a place that wants to give you a little cleaner place to stop today. BP. At BP, we've created a cleanliness rating system for all our stations. And so our floors, counters, pumps, coolers, and especially our bathrooms in over 10,000 locations nationwide can keep a consistent level of cleanliness. If you can have a little more comfortable place to stop, that's a little better. Stop in and see how refreshing a little better can be.
So, what would you rather have, the power to fly or the power to be invisible?
That's a dumb question.
Just pick one.
No, that's like asking what's better, the Big Mac or the Quarter Pounder with cheese.
Come on, just pick one.
No, man. No. You know, between all that beef and cheese and the Quarter Pounder with cheese and the fact that nothing eats like a Big Mac, you cannot say one is better than the other.
So would you rather fly or be invisible?
I'd rather go to McDonald's.
The equally desirable McDonald's Big Mac and Quarter Pounder with cheese sandwiches made with 100% USDA inspected beef. At participating McDonald's.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone and Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and good evening. Here's Al Gore.
Live Earth for the World began with a message from the Aboriginal peoples of Australia. In Africa, there is a proverb that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We have to go far, quickly.
Thank you, Al Gore. Live Earth, that's how it began. I'm Peter Werby. Joining me is Jalene Jordan.
Good evening.
And our number, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. It's a call-in talk show, one of those, you know, hi, you're on the air kind of deals. And let's get right to Live Earth. Yeah, I saw none of it,
right.
Actually. I heard a lot of it. WRIF was playing parts of it.
Yes.
And good music indeed. Tell me a little. you liked it, huh?
Well, I was actually on the air here when it started at 4 a.m. So I started watching it at 4 a.m. I watched quite a bit of it here and there, on and off. I haven't recorded. There's still parts that I need to see. But from what I did see, and I'll tell you, it's not an artist we play here, but Melissa Etheridge gave the most just mind-blowing performance, and in it she kept screaming things like, what happened to us, America? What happened to us, America? And she was so passionate, and she gave speeches in between her songs, you know, and got people pumped up about everything, you know. And she talked about her cancer and that she believes that it's the environment and things like that.
Now, Melissa Etheridge had breast cancer?
Oh, yeah, huh? Big time.
She was lying.
Yeah, and she's a survivor, and she's doing quite well. But she was, and then, of course, she does the title track. back to Al Gore's The Inconvenient Truth. So when she performed that, you know, it was overwhelming. And then in between all of the artists, they would go, I watched Bravo mostly.
Mm-hmm.
They would go in between all of the countries. There were a lot of artists who I was introduced to, that we all who watched this were introduced to. And in between, they would have snippets of you know, what's going on around the world, what global warming is doing all around the world. And then they had this this band from Antarctica.
Yeah.
And what was their name?
It was sold out. Something. Absolutely sold out in Antarctica.
These
25
guys
people.
Were great.
Yeah.
Yes.
I heard them interviewed.
They were great. And Enrique Iglesias even, you know, amazed me. These artists all had Katie Tunstall. I don't know if you know who she is. She's a new hot artist. They all either had some form of a T-shirt with a message on, or they gave some sort of message. I got to tell you, I mean, this is kind of a guilty pleasure admittance, but Duran Duran was fabulous.
Bring back the 80s.
Yeah.
Hey,
it was a great show.
Live Earth, as many as 2 billion people may have seen it. Snoop Dogg was at the Hamburg gig. So,
oh, yeah, I did see that. Yeah. I saw the old Snoop.
And Madonna.
Oh, well, jeez.
She was.
I tell you, how old is she? She's close to 50.
Yeah.
That woman is just on fire.
Yeah, she is.
You can't stop.
She's
Madonna.
Incredible. And hopefully, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Metallica,
yep.
Foo Fighters.
I saw all of that.
A little more familiar to WRIF audiences.
Right, absolutely. And one of the T-shirts that I saw in the audience that I really liked was more trees, less bush.
Well,
I thought that was
Given the music I just mentioned, Metallica and the other band.
Metallica was awesome.
Richard,
the Foo Fighters were fabulous.
Richard wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com that he heard our show for the first time. He says, I hate the music so much that I had to forward through it. He's listening online.
So I don't understand what he's talking about what music.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, in between, during commercials,
yeah.
Online, you get music.
You don't get the advertisements.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's three.
So he's not a rocker, is
yeah.
He's not,
well, he says, I don't understand why left-wing broadcasts use loud, raucous music. A lot of people don't like it. Not all progressives have the same musical taste. And he says, there are times when I like rock music of different types, but I don't feel that heavy metal is good for radio continuity. I'd appreciate a general toning down of the music. Same goes for promos, breaks, etc.
Okay, first of all, you need to talk. You're talking to the wrong person.
Right.
And that's our format, so it ain't going to happen.
That's the deal, because many of you who are listening.
We're an active rock station.
Yeah, many of you are listening around the country or around the world on the internet don't know that WRIF, most of the hours of the day, is just the big rocker in the Motor City.
It is.
Right. Back to
37 years strong, biggest rocker.
I was going to say.
As WRIF, Rolling Stone named us like the top rock station in the country several years back, and we really are the top active rock station in the country. It's a proud place to work.
And the show rocks.
And it does. And the station is cool for having this show on.
Absolutely, for so long. Hey, if you're listening anywhere in the world, just pick up your phone. It may be a little costly. Actually, we've had calls from overseas. Not so expensive anymore. But I wonder if others of you saw Live Earth and what your impression was.
313-298-WRIF.
Chris Rock, and then we can kind of get into the function of all the negative stuff that's come out about it. Chris Rock expressed the kind of disbelief shared by many on that day that Live Earth would make a lasting difference, even if he's only joking. He said in London, I pray that this event ends global warming the way that Live Aid ended world hunger.
I missed that.
That's so dumb.
Yeah,
So dumb because how can a rock concert end global hunger or end global warming? What it does is to bring these subjects to the fore.
Oh, my gosh.
Hello?
It educated so many people who did not know these things that were going on in between. You know, a lot of people watching for the music, right? Of course. But in between, the education was outstanding, and it brought knowledge to so many people who didn't know any of this stuff. That's what I was trying to tell a couple of my right-wing friends who said similar things.
You have right-wing friends?
Well,
I won't even say hello to
co-workers.
Oh, co-workers. Yeah, I'm always nice to my co-workers.
I love these guys. I do.
Okay.
You know, but they have their opinions.
I always say you're
because,
a nicer person than
because
I.
Because we do this show, they always feel they need to talk to me
about
this.
Oh, okay. They never talk to me. Are they saying? One guy calls me, you know, Jennifer Granholm was here at,
I wasn't here.
You weren't here. Governor Jennifer Granholm of Michigan was here for the dedication of the WRIF building.
Yes.
And so I walked in, and there's several stations here that's owned by our group, so not WRIF, but another one. I walked in, and the midday guy says, "Get out of here, Castro. I'm going to interview Governor Granholm." And I said, "How about if I tell her who you voted for? Because she's a, you know, a staunch Democrat."
Nice answer, Peter.
Yeah, but I can understand how rockers, particularly rock and roll DJs, can be right-wing. You know, it used to be, back in the day when we all started here in Detroit, that the management were all these far right-wing Republicans and just couldn't even... They couldn't get their minds around who we were and the music we played, but they knew it made money for them, right? And the way
sure.
we looked.
The bottom line.
The bottom line. It all. But now, like, all the management here is liberal, and some of the DJs are conservative.
Right. A few.
What's up with that?
A few.
I don't get it.
I don't get it either. Yeah. In the main, wouldn't you say that folks in the entertainment industry are
overwhelmingly
the activists and those who fall to the left?
Creative people who also have a tolerance for a wide variety of points of view. And this does not describe the right wing.
And a concern for all of these causes that the right wing just... Yeah. Thinks we're absolutely insane.
It's fascist to not make art. And this is art. Rock and roll is art. I mean, there are a few. I know you could say...
Wait, that's a bumper sticker.
Yeah. Well, actually, did he write this or did his brother? But a friend of mine, a prof, wrote a book on fascist art. And, you know, they can... But it's all this heroic art and, you know, it's like the people that that put portraits of Saddam Hussein everywhere in or Mao in China.
Sure.
I mean, they can paint and draw and do sculpture and all that, but there's not a bit of creativity at all because it's externally generated. Right?
Yes.
The great leader demands this homage to them through art, as opposed to what has always generated the creative spirit of all artists, and that is the listening to your own muse. And that's why stuff comes up that is so innovative, so incredible, so creative, and none of this comes from any right-wing artist.
That's so true. And I'm a proud lefty, and I just finished a song this weekend myself.
You want to sing it?
No.
Okay.
But when it's done... It'll be on my MySpace.
By the way, your MySpace page is fabulous.
Thank you.
If you can go to my page, not MySpace page, but my page, Peter Werber, PeterWerber.com, and look on the left. And actually, there's a real nice photograph of me and Jolene in the studio right here.
From last week
that Al... took?
Yes.
Yeah. Our co-producer. We now have two producers.
We do. Yeah. Jeremy's with us as well.
Yeah. And let's go back to Live 8, or Live Earth, right?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so one of these conservative colleagues of ours, a co-worker, they march in step to what they must have seen on Fox News.
It's definitely Fox News driven.
Yeah. And
no question.
And as we know, the more you watch, they've done these surveys, the more you watch Fox News, the less you know. I mean, it's inversely proportional.
Hmm.
Interesting. Yeah,
and not surprising.
No, I forgot the figures, but it's something like 60 or 70% of people that watch Fox News regularly.
Yeah.
They think that the United States found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
No, really?
They really do? Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
They do.
God.
But there's all
so
this
depressing.
Stuff. The worst stuff was this English paper, which, you can get just the first line. This News of the World, anyways, print it out. As Madonna bounds onto the huge Wembley stage to save the planet, how the assembled greenies will cheer. I mean, the cynicism here. Someone writes, right-wing artist Ted Nugent. There you go. I mean, there's a few.
We've only talked about him a couple of times
on
the air.
I don't know. I mean, is he crazy? Yeah, I don't want to take it away from him. Yeah, he's good. There are. I mean,
he can play a mean guitar.
Yeah. There were a couple of talk show hosts.
We'll give him that.
Yeah. There was a couple of talk show hosts in Detroit here right at the beginning of the, before the Iraq War began.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were going to, they were trying to raise money for a list of all the traitors in the rock industry that were opposed to the U.S. So I said, don't you think, I wrote him, and I said, don't you think
you're that's so scary.
I said, you're going to have to take out about 10 pages in Variety. That's where they're going to put it, in Variety magazine. I said, why don't you just take out all the pro, take out an ad and have all the pro-war right-wing rockers, and then you could have a little, like, eighth of a page ad and have about,
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, have about nine people on it.
Oh,
but all of this,
too much time on their hands.
What they really went into, and this is the talking point for these right-wingers, the most conservative assessment of the flights being taken by the superstars for Live Earth is that they are flying an extraordinary 222,623.63 miles between them to get to the various venues, nearly nine times.
They really thought this insanity out, didn't they?
So the idea is that that this is hypocritical, or it is contradictory at best. That I don't know what the let's give them all this. All right, Madonna has all these cars, and Roger Waters, Al Slayer was telling me that Roger Waters said, no, I don't live a green lifestyle at all. And I don't know that, I don't live like Ed Begley Jr.
Right. Is he really into it?
He's not. I mean, he spends all his living moments trying to live green, and it's a nice statement. But what we need are society-wide programs, and foremost, to completely end the use of fossil fuels, right? And some of these people...
That's a bold and large statement.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a couple people even talking about this a little that are waiting to talk. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743 for the Night Call Show. Peter and Jolene with you. But there is... This all drips with cynicism about these... and I see it on, I don't want to name some of these sites, I don't want to give them free advertising, but these right-wing sites that I look at, every single one of them is about the contradictions, like all these concerts created this much waste and what have you.
Yep.
So the idea is what? If you believe in ecology, you should go into a cave and go naked into a cave.
And hug a tree.
And hug a rock. You can't even hug a tree. You don't want to hug a tree naked. You'll be on the sex offenders list for the rest of your life. But that's because when you, the answer to, it's the News of the World. That's what it is. The News of the World, Britain's biggest selling newspaper, detailed the estimates of Madonna's carbon emissions from all of her houses and all of that. All of us would have to alter our lifestyles immensely. Like someone has said to me, oh, Pete, you travel all around the world, and you're always saying, we use too much fuel. Well, it's what you're advocating for, the way the society is going to energize itself, or the energy types it's going to use. I mean, we're going to kill ourselves, folks. We're going to kill off our species. There is no doubt about it, particularly as the third world begins to rise the level of industrial production of the first world, of us's, right? All the Chinese have cars. Right now, the Indians, the people of India, are more and more demanding air conditioners. And you think, hey, what the hell, man? It's pretty hot there. Well, they managed to live there for a long, long time. And I'm not saying, we North Americans should have air conditioners because, it's 78. Turn on the central air, where they're looking at like 112 or something like that. But the planet cannot take this. I mean, we cannot generalize the Western lifestyle to the rest of the world. I mean, we can create a world in which everyone is fed, where we can eliminate disease. The wealth and the know-how is here. It's just, as we were talking about that last week, you cannot drink clear water unless you get the hog out of the stream. And as long as you've got about 1,000 billionaires controlling a trillion, or what is it now? I think it's almost 1.5 trillion personal wealth. This is never going to come to be. So, I mean, if you want a clean world, an environmental world, we also have to look at the world and who controls what amount of wealth in it. All right? So, anyway, all of this, who else was there? Please, Red Hot Chili Peppers, UB40, Red Wine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have they done anything since then?
I think that was about it. But it's still, they're still getting paid royalties on it.
That's a good band. let's take some calls right now. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see. Here is Bill. Bill is in Roseville. Hi, Bill. Wait a minute. Did I do that right? No, didn't work. Let's try it again. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
We're doing good. What's going on?
All right. Not much. Yeah, I was calling because sort of you said there were no right-wing artists. You know, yeah, I know you rebutted later and said maybe nine or so, but, you know, it's like, well, Uncle Ted here in Detroit, you know, I mean, there's a lot of creativity there. You know, he's sort of...
Right.
Yeah, and we did say that he's one hell of a guitar
right.
player.
What's
you know?
Yeah, I was on the phone with the screener, so I didn't catch
well,
that.
Well, here,
yeah,
Bill,
yeah.
What's his nickname? Yep. What's Ted Nugent's nickname?
The Motor City Madman.
You know what? He doesn't live in Michigan anymore, and he no longer calls himself the Motor City Madman. He calls himself, do you remember what, Julie?
No, the something of Texas.
The Texas Wild Man, because he lives next to his buddy.
Right.
So he's abandoned you.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
But, you know, on the right wing front, I mean, with me, you know, I grew up in a Democratic household, liberal household. But with me, it seems like the Democrats have gone to the point now where everything is doom and gloom. And
well, it is. It is doom and gloom.
There's no positive message. I never hear any ideas on how to correct it or this and that. Just that, you know, everything is so doomy and gloomy and that it's hopeless and that none of us can think for ourselves. And
well, I don't know the last part, but the doom and gloom has been created by the Bush administration, both economically and politically, militarily. And are the Democrats just filled with grand ideas and positive visions? No, you're absolutely right. And that's their failing. That's their failing. If they would listen to the base... The vast majority of people who consider themselves Democrats, they would come up with a program filled with solutions. But they're nervous Nellies, and they always think, "Oh, I don't want to offend the center, so I just have to wait for everyone to dislike the Republicans so badly that everything will fall into our hands, and then we'll be able to institute." What do we want to institute? You know, they don't have anything. That's the problem. All right, Bill, thank you very much. And there are lots of things that, in fact, could be instituted. Wait a minute. Here we got a little
I'll tell you a right. I'll tell you a right-wing musician in the country world, which
oh,
I don't,
forget
I don't
the
listen
country
to
world.
I don't listen to it, but that damn Reba McEntire.
And Toby Keith.
Oh, she's so repulsive. Oh.
Oh, can't they see, you know, they're...
And he's just as bad. Those two together.
Well, he's singing. He's not singing all those kick-ass songs anymore. He's, you know, they go, ooh, maybe the Dixie Chicks were right after all, right?
He's not?
I don't
know.
He's got a new hit out. I'm trying to think what it is.
I'm glad that I don't.
If I heard him singing, I would have I'd be clueless as to who he was.
Well, I would too.
I read about this.
Yes, exactly.
All right, let's see. Let's go to Jim. Jim's in Warren. Hi, Jim. Peter and Jolene. What? Hey, Jim.
Jim, you're live.
Jim, you're.
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, I just want to know something about all these hybrid cars that are having these acid batteries. Where are we going to bury them?
You're right. And listen, how about this for hybrid cars as well? Say we all went all electric. How are we going to generate the electricity necessary to power them?
You tell me.
I don't know.
And the thing about it is they blame Bush for this stuff. Wait a minute. This started years before Bush. I mean, it actually started when Clinton was in office.
What did? Global warming? Yeah, you know, I think Clinton's...
Is it Clinton's fault?
Clinton's fault. he actually didn't dork her, did he? Well, whatever he was doing with Monica Lewinsky, kept his eye off the ball, and he allowed global warming to manifest itself.
No, I'm not saying that. But did he do anything to divert it or try to start anything in progress?
Well, you know what? You're talking to the wrong people if you're expecting me or Jalene to defend the Clinton-Gore
right.
administration. Many environmentalists were extraordinarily critical of Clinton, said that they failed completely to carry out the mandate again. That the base, the Democratic Party base, the voters, thought that they were carrying out Al Gore's book. What's that 1992 book? You remember the name of it? Anyway, it laid out a vision of environmental sanity that never really got into, that was never put into action. I mean, Clinton really crumpled on it. And also, but on the way out, he signed a lot of executive orders that protected the environment, that set aside roadless areas, and old George W.
It's all been
he just scratched
taken away.
Mining? You want that land? Okay. Cut down all these natural areas? Okay. Lumber industry. On and on and on like that. So. Pose in the world, and the world of ideas is much larger than these presidential candidates. And I mean, it'd make a lot of sense for us to think way. What's the cliche? No, think way outside of the box. And the box is what we're in. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I was looking for. Oh, I can't find it. It was that whole thing. Remember, we were talking about alternative fuels. Say something for me.
Here.
I don't know if that's...
Is that it?
That's right. It's on top of the fact that Al Gore's son got busted.
Oh, yeah. He was getting high, I think.
Well, let's see.
Allegedly.
Al Gore's son was arrested Wednesday. What a doofus. His dad's about to launch, Live Earth.
Not a smooth move.
And he gets arrested.
Oh.
He's driving his blue Toyota Prius about 100 miles an hour. I didn't even know they go that fast on the San Diego freeway.
Yeah.
And so he had an ounce of weed along with Xanax, Valium, Vicodin, and Adderall.
He was either getting high or getting other people high. And you know what? Someone said to me yesterday, well, now Al Gore can never be president. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? George Bush snorted half of Peru.
That's right. And
And he is president.
Yeah, and he's actually the only...
resident.
The only president ever to enter the White House with an arrest record. Bush.
Bushes?
Yeah. More than, and some people say that he had a cocaine arrest that was suppressed.
No.
Yeah. More than half of the Prius buyers, according to the New York Times, surveyed this spring by CNW Marketing Research, said the main reason they purchased their car was that it makes a statement about me.
No, it's ego.
Yeah. Well, that's not so bad. If you think about...
Oh, well, whatever.
Well, no, you know what I mean?
Even though with these acid batteries, I need to look more into this.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a... I don't know what we could do, but we've got ourselves in a bad way.
Yes, we do.
Because we're bad to the bone.
What happened to us, America? What happened? But she kept yelling.
Melissa Etheridge. All right, we're going to take a break, and actually, I'll tell you a little about ethanol when we come back.
Oh, you know what else she said?
What?
When she was a kid, she said, we had a president who was a criminal. And then she gave this kind of funny face.
Like Nixon.
Yeah. And get it? Like.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Current times, baby.
All right. You're listening to Night Call on WRIF. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. You want to call while we're taking our break? 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Look More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Let's do a little Neil Young. That's what George W. Bush has done, shipped all of our money out the door, but it's not, as I always say, it's not like it was lost in the laundry. Those billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars that could have been spent here on having free college education, a universal health plan, free college, did I say that? Free college education? What else was I was thinking? Well, oh, yeah, a transportation system that would not necessitate private cars going everywhere we go. What else? A free postal system for free personal letters. I mean, 41 cents now? I mean, come on. I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but well, Jillian Jordan with me as well.
Everything's rising. Everything.
Let's hear more. Breaking every law in the country, the Neil Young from the Living with War LP. Let's impeach the president. When he was touring with Crosby, Stills, and Nash last summer, everywhere they went, they would sing that song, and the entire audience would get on their feet, and the words were projected onto the screen. Yeah. So that was generally thought, impeaching Bush and impeaching Cheney was generally thought to be some far-out left-wing people like us, right? I mean, Jolene.
Yeah.
But get this, and this is a right-wing news site, Breitbart.com. They report nearly half of the U.S. public wants President George W. Bush to face impeachment and even more favor that fate for Vice President Dick Cheney. The survey by the American Research Group found that 45% support the U.S. House of Representatives beginning impeachment proceedings against Bush. 1% more oppose it, 46%, so it's split. But when it comes to Cheney, 54% to 40% want the House of Representatives to begin impeachment proceedings against these two guys that have broken every law, trashed the Constitution, got us into this war on the basis of lies, and just continue on their criminal activities. This email from Jim, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. For over 6 years, he says, there's been a criminal regime operating out of the White House. And he asked people to join a picket of Representative Sander Levin's Roseville office. He's my rep. And I'm just totally blanking on what district it is. To push the congressman to do his job and impeach Bush and Cheney, or at least co-sponsor Representative Dennis Kucinich's House Resolution 333 to impeach Cheney. 333, that's half of 666. So they're going to have a picket line at his Gratiot office just north of I-696 on the third Saturday of each month from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. I think the resolution has only 14 sponsors, and I actually...
It has 9, and a 10th set to sign on when the House returns to work next week.
I read that, but I think it's 14.
Okay.
Okay, we'll see.
This is a right-wing website. They've got to be wrong about a couple
Well, this
of things.
Is also...
I think they're right about this, though. Democratic leaders appear unlikely to pursue such a course.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said. They just want to think, Bush is so unpopular. It's like 26%, and what do you always say? There's a 3% margin of error.
Margin of error, so it's 23.
Yeah. Do those right-wingers that work here, do they still support Bush? Not all of them, I know.
Well, remember the one who took the sticker off of the car?
Yeah.
Yeah, he may still kind of, he doesn't support him, but I think he's still on the right.
Yeah, well, that's good. it's good he doesn't support him anymore.
Well, yeah, and that he took the sticker off of him.
We were going to talk about, about ethanol, but I'll get to that in a minute because a lot of you have been waiting very patiently. Let's go to Drake. Drake is in Waterford. Go ahead, Drake, you're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Hi.
Peter and Jolene, how are you this evening?
Doing great.
Great.
Excellent. Long-time listener and first-time caller. Love your show.
Thank
Welcome.
You.
Bottom line is we're all going to always, generally, almost all of us are always going to look for the easier, softer way out of anything, whether it be transportation to and from work or whether it be a way to take care of our kids while we go to work. Another thing that pops up into that is massive population growth across the world.
Sure.
With the massive population growth, everyone that turns of age 16, at least here in America, is, of course, first of all, looking for a car. They're not absolutely looking for a Prius or something that's electrically moved, but something that's got some gas power to it and it's going to be cool and make them look good so they can get bottom line laid.
That's true.
It's kind of sad.
That's where I was at.
Well, hey, so was I. Why not?
And it worked.
It's fueling consumption is the bottom line. And I mean, when people are afraid that they don't meet up to the standards of the Joneses next door, they're going to buy a nicer car. In fact, if you look at a lot of the parking lots that were at the aid thing yesterday, most of them were probably SUVs.
Sure.
Now, that is kind of contradictory. The thing begins at home, and it starts with self-discipline. Many of us are hard to be, it's hard to be self-disciplined, myself included. The population thing, it's inevitable. We're going to run out of oil someday. Probably not in our lifetime.
Well, but you know, that there's not just this geometric or exponential growth of population. Populations tend to level off, but we're still dealing with an extraordinary amount of a particular species. I mean, it never was like this. There's more people alive today than have ever lived on Earth previously. And usually when a species overpopulates, it can have pretty disastrous consequences. Now, you know, this is kind of weird after I was just saying about Cheney, but Cheney said that a lot of this recycling and all that is more like a gesture. And a gesture, of course, someone like him, gestures don't mean much, but in many ways, it is a gesture. I think sometimes I recycle a lot of stuff, and there's lots of problems with recycling, which I don't want to get into now.
I love your recycling argument, but you don't have to get into
okay,
it.
Okay, it's really too long. So I do all this recycling, then my neighbor has like 9 trash cans. I mean, I'll tell you real quickly. It used to be a triad of reduce, reuse, recycle. The idea was that the Earth could not keep on exploiting the Earth, producing what we do, and creating all this waste, and continue to not destroy the basis of life on the planet. So the idea was to reduce production and consumption, which is death almost to capitalism. It has to keep expanding. So we got a real contradiction right there. What do we do about that? I mean, how do we live in a system that has to have always expanding, always have to expand its wealth, always has to expand its productive apparatus, which means we always have to...
iPhone.
Yeah, we have to have expanding consumers with new... more and more gadgets.
Bye.
Right. So first you got to reduce everything and then deal with the consequences of that. Secondly, you got to reuse what can be reused. And the idea that, of course, I was talking with a producer from way back, Jim Edelman, and he always remembers when I came in one time from Wendy's and told on the air on this show, I had something like 19 pieces in this little Wendy's meal of disposable stuff that I actually used. So what do we do? We're going to bring little glass jars to Wendy's instead of having styrofoam cups. Well, I mean, what if the choice is, and I know this sounds maybe extreme to some people, but we have to do that or the planet dies.
Well, how about this whole, all the bottled water we're drinking and all the plastic, bottles it's creating? That's pretty bad. I'm actually drinking tap water again these days.
It's not bad in Detroit.
I know.
Detroit's got some of the better stuff.
That's the only reason.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we get more and more diverted. Let me see. Where did we say? Oh, yeah. So how do you live on the planet? Well, the way I live on the planet with some ecological consciousness probably doesn't seem too much different from most Americans. I mean, for one thing, most Americans consume to the level of their income, what kind of disposable income they have. I mean, we want to get.
Or beyond.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem as well. So I remember someone saying, oh, Pete, you're always talking about oil and how terrible it is, and you fly all around the world. Well, the fact that Madonna has four, six, nine cars and what have you, or they these people traveled all these miles to get to these venues, and people at the Live Earth concerts created X amount of waste, isn't the question. The question is, what is this species going to be all about? Are we going to live sensible within our means? Are we going to, you know, there's an old phrase called carrying capacity. In other words, for ferrets or any little animal, what kind of what capacity does a particular environment have to carry that species? Well, the book is called Overshoot, and we have way overshot our carrying capacity, and we're living on everything is living on debt. We're living on ecological debt. And like everything, like this economy, like our personal finances, you carry debt too long, it's going to really come back to bite us in the butt. And biting us in the butt ecologically, what's that going to be? Well, we've heard some of the worst horror stories, so we better start figuring some of this stuff out. Let's talk about baseball.
What?
Thank you very much. Yeah, how about those Tigers?
They're doing well.
They are doing well. What are they, in the Central Division, I think tied with Cleveland now?
Well, now you know more than I
won a 13th inning squeaker on Friday night.
Oh, but, yes, and I did know about that.
Yeah, but I'm going to be playing in a baseball game.
Oh, yes.
Which we'd like to invite everyone to. It's the Detroit Artist versus the Detroit Writers.
I kind of want to see this.
Oh, you should. It's called the Softball Challenge.
I don't know why I find it amusing.
And there's going to be a party after. So it's at Detroit's Clark Park. And it's in the southwest side of Detroit. Google it or something like that. It's around Verner and Clark. That will be good for you. It's going to be Saturday, July 14th. So it is next week? Yeah, next Saturday.
Yeah.
Next Saturday. You know, I've got actually have this Tai Chi master coming in from Taiwan that I've got to do that all day and then try to play second base. I don't know.
Well, you're going to be all zenned out. That might be a good thing.
The first pitch by Tiger Great, the last 30-game winner in the American League, or maybe in Major League Baseball, Danny McLain, is going to throw out the first pitch at 6 p.m. Yeah, he's out. He's out. He's served his time. And you didn't know he was in?
No.
Yeah, well, a couple times.
All right.
But he's got a book called I Told You I Wasn't Perfect. He's going to be signing those maybe at the field, 4 p.m. Danny McLain's going to throw out the first pitch. So it's Detroit Artists versus Detroit Writers, Softball Challenge, Clark Park, Saturday, July 14th, 6 p.m. And free admission, by the way, free admission. Sponsored by Como's, the pizzeria up in Italian restaurant up in
Ferndale
and
9 miles.
My friends at Travel Art who take art and ship it all around the country. But,
nice.
Okay, so.
That sounds like a good
And this is all presented by the Detroit Artist Market, where they have baseball as art, and you can go to thedetroitartistmarket.org.
We don't talk a lot about baseball on this.
No, we don't. So take me out to the ball game.
Good luck to you.
What is making me. Oh, yeah. But another thing that we're doing, and we now is Jalene and I, we are going to host.
No End in Sight.
Right. It's a brand new documentary about how we got in, not how we got into this mess in Iraq. We got into the mess in Iraq by Bush and the rest of his cronies purposely lying and misrepresenting what was going on.
And if you haven't figured that out, yeah.
But this is, let me see if I can do this, because on my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com, I had a photograph on here an hour ago, and it said click on it, and then you'd go to the page where you get...
Now it's gone, but you're going to fix it.
Free passes, yeah.
And it's Thursday, May 19th.
At 7:30 p.m.
At?
The Main Art Theater in 11 Mile in Maine in Royal Oak.
Favorite theater.
And Jalene and I will be, it says, moderating a post-film discussion.
Yeah, which means you will be. I'll be there with you for support.
I'll do my best. But it's free. It's free tickets.
You're a great moderator, what I'm saying.
I am. Shut up! Oh no, that's that right wing guy. I'm turning off. Turn off his mic.
No, remember when I was on CNN or no, it was MSNBC that one time, and that one right wing host said, "You're done. You know what? You're done talking." And that was not a very good thing to say to me.
Uh-huh.
I lost it.
Shade him up.
I did.
Yeah. So anyway, coming up Thursday, July 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Royal Oak Main Art Theater.
Yeah.
The documentary, brand new special preview, no end in sight. So please join us. It's all free. That's
wow. I didn't know that part.
Yeah, it's free. All right. Here's Dave in St. Clair Shores. Dave, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air with Peter and Jalene. Hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
I'm a pretty new listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
And wondering, I didn't really get to catch the Live Earth event because it was my birthday party, and I was kind of partying. But
happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. But I was curious, was there any political statements made by any of the artists?
Oh, yeah, tons of them. I mean, almost every single one.
Snoop.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember what the dog said. Yeah, by almost every single one. And they even went into other topics like Iraq, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because one of the main reasons, I mean, whenever you guys were talking earlier, you were talking about Fox News, and we know how corrupt Fox News is, and basically it's all corporate control one end or another.
Well, they read White House press releases, and then they repeat them.
Yeah, it's a megaphone, essentially, for the liars in the White House.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And so we need support for somebody from people like you guys. I mean, I don't know if you guys, have any of you looked into Ron Paul at all?
The Republican presidential candidate, who is a furious candidate, furious
I understand what it's about, right?
Yeah.
I understand what he's about, but I'm going to make a very strong statement here, but I'm going to do it delicately.
Go ahead.
I will never, ever, ever vote for a Republican.
It'd be pretty hard for me to do it. He also is very, very pro-choice because he's a libertarian.
Yeah, so great.
Yeah. Thank
God there's one of them. Thank God. Okay, Ron Paul. But I won't vote for him.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Susan in Farmington. Susan, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about the Lewis Scooter Libby part.
Oh, Peter, we haven't even gotten to that. There's
Man,
so much going on.
How thick is this sheath of paper ready to roll?
Yeah,
on
I have a pile.
What do you think, Susan?
Well, I think it's real interesting that Bush pardoned him during the 4th of July holiday when basically everybody's out, doing fun in the sun stuff.
I didn't even think about that.
Oh, yeah.
So that it doesn't hit the news.
Yeah.
And on July 5th, Libby goes in and pays his fine.
Yeah,
$250,000.
Yeah. What did he do? He just went in his pocket and said, here. I mean, all those guys are rich, going to stay rich. One of the things about these right-wing Republicans, they never pay the cost. It's always the little guy who has to, you know, to take the shaft.
Well, let's not forget what he supposedly did, and the people around him, Cheney and Bush's operatives, outing a CIA agent,
mm-hmm.
And they said they would get whoever did this. Bush said, we will get whoever
did this. No, he didn't say
it
yet. He said, whoever did this will be taken care of.
Thank you. Oh, wait a minute. That's right, Peter. That is, and he has been taken
care of.
Him.
Yeah.
Great point.
And anybody that she had anything to do with throughout the world could very well be dead by now.
Well, they could suffer all sorts of consequences. Let me, Susan, just quickly read a few words from William Rivers Pitt, who is a columnist. We've interviewed him on this show before, from truthout.org. Truthout.org was commuting Libby an impeachable offense. Here's the summary of it in case people don't know about it. Libby was part of a White House plot to discredit Ambassador Joseph Wilson, whose early criticism of the administration's Iraq claims were deemed a grave threat to their policy because he was telling the truth. The White House attacked Wilson by exposing his wife, Valerie Plame, as a deep-cover CIA operative. The exposure destroyed the intelligence network she had created to track any person, nation, or group that might give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. Libby lied under oath and obstructed justice to cover up these White House activities and to protect Vice President Cheney from scrutiny and censure for his direct role in the plot. And now, you may remember, and I got to go pretty quickly because we got to get these spots in before midnight, Susan. But When somebody mentioned Nixon before, when it came out that Nixon had taped all this stuff, his secretary Rosemary Woods deleted 14 minutes of the tape. She just erased it, and people were saying, "Oh my word! How could anybody do anything horrible? Doesn't this show just how corrupt and venal that Nixon is and Rosemary Woods is?" And what people finally came to the conclusion was there was only one thing worse than Rosemary Wood deleting those 14 minutes, and that would have been for Nixon to allow what was on those 14 minutes to come to public scrutiny. Same thing here. Bush is not about, you know, it's excessive or it's one of his, close associates that he takes care of. He wanted to position Libby so he could not do the exposure of the White House lies about the run-up to the Iraq that he would have to testify to. All right, I'm going to talk more about it, but thank you, Susan. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Peter and Jalene, 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. Joining me, Jalene Jordan. Our phone number and some open lines for the first time tonight, 313-298-WRIF. You know, I've got some mental block on these. I have to read these, and I'm stumbling on it. What is up with that?
I don't know, Peter, because you've been here for a very
long time. And it's always been the same, too. 313-298-9743, which I haven't memorized. We were talking just a little while ago about a couple of events. One was this Detroit Artists versus Detroit Writers softball challenge on Saturday, July 14th at Detroit's Clark Park, which I'll be participating in. And also another event, which will be on Thursday, July 19th at the Main Art Theater in Royal Oak, where we will, in fact, we are offering you, the listening audience, free passes for this special preview, the new documentary, No End in Sight. All of this is at my website, peterwerby.com, peterwerbe.com. And you can go to the calendar page, and there's a listing for it. I don't actually, you know what? I don't think I put the film on there yet. Also,
you'll get it all together.
Yeah, there is my MySpace page, which Jolene administers, and Jolene's website page, and a couple photos. A photo of you with where you, there's a you and Jolene has is a great singer. And
MySpace.com/ Jolene Jordan Music.
Whew. Go to my page.
MySpace.com/ Night Call Detroit.
Yeah, because people always have trouble spelling your name, which is J-U-L-I-N-E.
Yes,
Jordan.
It's a different one.
You should have been, well, Mary's not so exciting. Apologies to all the Marys.
Now listen.
Jolene is very cool.
Unique is good.
Yeah,
it was my name is, you know how a lot of people change their name in radio?
Yeah.
Jolene Jordan is my birth name, and I think my parents knew it was perfect that I was going to be in radio.
Oh,
it's a perfect name for that.
Hotline's ringing. Maybe we're fired.
It's always pick up the hotline,
yeah.
Al.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to Scooter Libby. So here's the guy that fell on the grenade for the mob, you know, for the.
He really did.
Yeah.
For Cheney.
For Cheney, because they knew that this would get back. You know that. All of a sudden, I got a little brain dead there for a second. They knew that if Scooter Libby would have told the truth to the FBI investigators, that it would have brought down the whole Bushco mob in the White House. Actually, let me see. When is this from? This is from July 3rd. So this is before the commutation that William Rivers Pitt says, despite these serious crimes of lying under oath and obstructing justice, he says Libby will spend less time in prison than Paris Hilton, Martha Stewart, and Susan McDougal. Or maybe this is after. The same Republicans who championed the impeachment of Bill Clinton now celebrate Libby's liberation from the consequences of the very same acts they accused Clinton of committing. I mean, these guys are such hypocrites. And we talked about the fact that Libby, I, Louis Libby Jr., you know, he wrote porn novels, too.
What?
Yeah, that's true.
No.
Really.
Saddam Hussein wrote romance novels. Remember
well,
that?
Whatever, yeah, he did. Paid $250,000. Here, according to Justice Department standard, remember, Bush said that he supported the verdict. This was very, very strange. He supported the verdict of him being guilty, but he thought the penalty was excessive.
Oh, give me a break. Of course he did.
According to Justice Department standards, requests for commutations generally are not accepted unless and until a person has begun serving that sentence. This is a quote from their standards. And they are generally not granted to those appealing their convictions, which is Libby's doing now. Cooperation with prosecutors is usually considered a factor in granting such requests. With such minor exceptions, according to Margaret Colgate Love, who was the pardon lawyer at the Justice Department for most of the 90s, she said, with just some minor exceptions, I can't think of a recent commutation that was granted before at least some prison time was served. Right?
So what did you say just a little bit ago, that he's spending less time in jail because he's really not been in jail, has
right.
he?
Well, he won't.
Then Paris Hilton?
And
Martha Stewart?
Right.
Oh, my.
Right.
Okay, this is... I mean, this should really
PO
some people.
I respect the jury's verdict, but I've concluded the prison sentence given to Mr. Libby is excessive.
Okay.
So, is it? Well,
that's really all I can say.
I've got these in the wrong order. Yeah. Bush, and through his government, filed a motion last year to uphold the 33-month sentence, which was about what Libby got, of Victor Rita, a 24 Marine Corps vet convicted of the same crimes as Libby. Last month, the Supreme Court agreed with the Bush Justice Department, ruling against Rita's appeal for a reduced sentence based on his exemplary military service. Because one of the things that Bush has said is that Scooter Libby has just given such service to America. Like what? He was part of the whole lie machine that got us into
Iraq
in the first place. Yeah. Last year, the Bush administration filed what's called a friend of the court brief with the Supreme Court in an attempt to uphold the lower court's ruling that a 33-month prison sentence for Victor Rita was reasonable. But now, Bush cited Libby's years of exceptional public service in commuting his prison sentence. But Libby is the classic bushy chicken hawk, according to the Pensito Review, a neocon bureaucrat with no military service record whose fingerprints are all over the worst military planning in American history. So again, so you say, why did Bush do this? Because didn't he know that he was going to get more criticism? That he had to protect Cheney even more so. Now, this is amazing. President, this is cron.com. Well, it must be maybe the San Francisco Chronicle. Oh, the Houston Chronicle. Houston, this is Texas. This at cron.com. It's a small world for Pardons. Bush's commutation of Lewis Scooter Libby's prison sentence highlights some of the interesting connections between Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, a former fugitive from justice, and ex-president two leading 2008 White House hopefuls. Now, hear what this is all about. Before entering government, well, one of the things that the Bushies and the conservatives say, yeah, Clinton pardoned Mark Rich, who was this billionaire international commodities trader who was indicted in 1983 by who was then U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani on charges of tax evasion and illegally dealing with Iran during the American hostage crisis. And this this Mark Rich fled to Switzerland, and he was also on the FBI's most wanted list. Now, Clinton, his fugitive days ended when Clinton pardoned him in January 2001, a move that prompted a congratulatory call from Scooter Libby, who was Mark Rich's attorney. So here are all these Republicans. This is amazing. All these Republicans saying, Clinton did it. So they hate Clinton, but they're saying that Bush is the ethical equivalent of Clinton?
Yeah, once again.
Or wait a minute. Yeah, Bush is the ethical equivalent of Clinton?
Once again, makes no sense.
So Libby was Mark Rich's attorney.
Oh, it's all so insane, Peter.
Yeah.
It really
is. Do these people ever suffer any penalties? And what you got to remember, too, that Bush 1 pardoned six members of his administration at his last day in office, because they're always saying, you know, Clinton pardoned 120 people. Well, these were, you know, none of these were political crimes. Daddy Bush, Poppy Bush, he pardoned people in his administration that had committed all these crimes around arming Iran. And, and violating the Constitution. That was what Iran-Contra was about. These men, I have no respect for the Constitution, no respect for the rule of law whatsoever. They're a band of criminals. They're not even a political party. They ought to be prosecuted. The whole Republican Party ought to be prosecuted under the RICO statute. What is it? Racketeering? What's RICO stand for? Corrupt organization.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, for sure. Anything more on here? Oh, yeah. Now everybody is going to be appealing long sentences based on what, let me see, they had a word for it here. The Libby defense.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The Libby clemency will be the basis for many legal arguments, says Susan James, an Alabama lawyer representing Don E. Siegelman, the state's former governor, who is appealing a sentence he received last week of 88 months for obstruction of justice.
Oh.
Scooter got 30. Right?
Yeah.
And this rising star in the Democratic Party in Alabama, who was the governor, many who think that this was another, I mean, he could have been corrupt. Who knows? You know, it's not like the Republicans are the only ones, but they just do it the most.
Yeah, politicians.
Yeah,
in general,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. In commuting Libby's 30-month sentence on Monday, President Bush drew on the same array of arguments about the federal sentencing system often made by lawyers. Let's see. Elizabeth De La Vega, who is a federal prosecutor in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and San Jose for more than 20 years. She's the author of the book, U.S. versus George Bush et al., said, the president has the constitutional power to commute sentences, but in this case, where the defendant whose sentence he is commuting in his is his former top advisor, and where both the president and the vice president are implicated in the same investigation that led to the charges against that advisor, the president's exercise of that prerogative is an egregious, which means bad, abuse of power. The judge imposed a sentence in accordance with the sentencing guidelines. Indeed, it was the most lenient sentence available under the applicable guideline range. Yet Bush, with no explanation whatsoever, has arbitrarily deemed the sentence excessive and obliterated. So this is an outlaw regime that rules us.
You know, I'm feeling sorry for Paris Hilton right now.
Yeah, Yeah, she's never. This is a racket posing it as a government. We must be done with it. We cannot stand another 18 months of it.
Impeach Bush.
Here's Marianne and Dearborn. It's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Peter, Jalene.
Hi.
Hello.
I was wondering if you're aware of the fact that Marvin Bush, George Bush's brother, was head of security of the World Trade Center for years before the bombing of the World Trade Centers.
Yep, it all kind of fits together, doesn't it?
It's enough
to make you a conspiracy buff. Like, actually, all these elites run our lives, and they're all in it to fleece us, because that's what a racket is. It cheats people out of money. So we, more and more, the American public, work our butts off, get rewarded less and less, get less and less benefits. And this racket in Washington takes our money and gives it to the sub-rackets that they control. Well, you know, the preparation for war, the cleanup of the war after, the so-called reconstruction. And all of this is being paid by you and me. So we don't get a universal health care system because there ain't no money for it. I mean, forget about it. We could have, what was I saying earlier, free college education, which we should have, reduced postal rates, subsidized gasoline. I mean, if his buddies
more mass transportation, better education.
Yeah, better roads. Ferries. Why don't we have like 10, 12 ferries across all the lakes here in Michigan? Huh?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Hey. I mean, that's what we could do with our money.
Let's do that, too.
Rather than turning it over to the sub-rackets like Halliburton.
I feel like listening to the song After the Revolution right now by David Rovin.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Thank you, Marianne. Appreciate your call.
Yeah.
Stella. Stella, I'm sorry. We kind of... We missed you here. You've been waiting a long time. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Me?
You, Stella. Go ahead.
Oh, wow. I was going to say something about Libby. You know, I'm glad that they commuted his sentence because this administration is so secretive. At least this puts a spotlight on how corrupt they are.
Sure.
They're going to come back and they're going to regret this. But I think it's a good thing. You know, his name is Scooter. How long would he have lasted in prison?
Well, there you go.
But what really scares me is that this country has regressed so much during the Bush years that I don't think a black man or a white woman is going to be president. And I think if either one of those is a nominee, we're going to end up with one of these Republican freaks.
Well, that could be, but here's what's the dream ticket? Gore and Kucinich.
Yeah, right.
Or actually, I'd like to see Gore was a good vice president, so I'd like to see Kucinich and Gore.
Right.
I'd like to see Biden and Edwards because I think at least it's the middle of the road. I mean, we're not going to swing all the way to the left.
Well, I don't think this country can take middle of the road. I mean, we've gone so far to the right that there's been so much damage done on every level of social legislation that affects every single person in this country negatively that somebody's got to be as radical a reformer as somebody like Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Remember, he was denounced as a communist by all the rich people and that he was destroying the country and all his programs were socialistic, like giving us Social Security, stuff like that. He wanted to have a health program. In fact, so did Harry Truman, but they were beat back by the propaganda from the American Medical Association and the corporations. You know, Ronald Reagan. In fact, you can see that in Sicko. Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't, and I really want to see it, but I'm too cheap to go to the show, so I'm waiting until it comes out on DVD.
Well, it will be. I don't know. These days, doesn't a DVD cost more than a... Yeah, it does.
Well, maybe she's renting.
Go to michaelmoore.com, see what's up with that. Thank you, Stella, calling in from Hamtramck. Speaking of Sicko, Mike writes in from Redford. He's a regular listener of Night Call and listens on his way home. He saw Sicko and thought it was well made, though I wish it did a better job at painting how much more efficient European healthcare models are compared to our own. We, the United States, spend twice as much as the French and 2.5 times as much as the British, and yet all their citizens are cared for with no out-of-pocket expense. Mike works in a hospital, and he says the cost of having to push all this paper around to deal with all these different managed care programs are staggering. I don't know the exact figures, but I know it's many millions of dollars. It would be more cost-efficient to deal with one payer, the government, like they have in these other countries. Then there's paying for all the overhead in the managed care companies themselves, the claims specialists, advertising, lobbying Congress. Remember, Michael Moore had a list of 900 healthcare lobbyists. Imagine what they're being paid and what they're spending. All the phone operators, as well as the executives with their millions of dollars in compensation and perks. No wonder the premiums are staggering, he says, for less and less service. Let's see. Oh, yeah, and this is where it's beginning. I can argue the cost-benefit analysis all I want, but the people with the money want this inefficient and expensive system in place. I mean, I want to read that again because Mike is absolutely right. The people with the money want this inefficient and expensive health system in place because they want to keep Americans in a perpetual state of debt. 40% of bankruptcies filed were a result of hospital bills. This wanting to control the masses with debt is not capitalism, it's feudalism. What ticks me off to no end is even our champions of national health care are bought off. Another reason he says I will refuse to vote for Hillary Clinton. Now, here's the big question for Mike. And I don't have anything too much to say. He says, is there anything else we can do? Now, popular movements have founded this country. Revolutionary movement of the 18th century. But we've abolished slavery. We've brought women the vote. We've ended wars. We've gotten respect for and legal standing for first for slaves and then ending segregation. All this was done with popular movements. So that is the movement of the people. Isn't that there's a Bob Marley in the Wailers? Movement of the people.
That's
a great song. I'm not doing much justice. Anyway. 2008 candidates vowed to overhaul U.S. health care. Don't buy this stuff from any of them, the Democrats and certainly not the Republicans. What they want to do is they want to turn more and more of this over to the private insurance companies. Got to put those people out of business, get them honest work, get them out of health care, and make sure that they are not profiting by our health care.
Absolutely. And you know what? You can sing, Peter. So don't
I can't. Anybody can sing. We saw a Ratatouille the other night. Anyone can cook. Even a rat. Pixar, Disney.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah.
So sometimes you just surprise me.
I like it.
You go on vacation and watch right-wing news.
Yeah. Let's go to Jeffrey in Wixom. Jeffrey, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Peter and Jalene. It's a pleasure to talk on your show.
Hey, thank you.
I'm a retired Marine Corps veteran, and I'd like to suggest some things about the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton era that, you know, in 92 we heard Perot discuss the NAFTA agreement,
mm-hmm.
and you're now feeling the effects of 10 to 12 years later when the sucking sound he predicted actually occurs.
Absolutely. It's all coming home to roost.
It's a crying shame. I saw it coming. I voted for Perot. And this country is really being ripped apart by its internal structures there in Washington that actually do not listen to the wishes of the people. Instead, it's being funded and it's corrupt. They need to absolutely wipe out the entire organization in Washington and replace those with citizens that are more interested in the republic of this country than they are in the dollars that it can generate.
Yeah, well, I don't have much to add to that.
Well put.
You guys are great. I enjoy your show, and thank you kindly for leaving me the opportunity to make my statement.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Good night, guys.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now. Just the fact that he said he was a Marine vet reminded me. In fact, I got so much here, I'm not going to...
Do you have your Iraq pile?
I have my Iraq pile.
Yeah,
yeah. And extraordinary... the editorial in the New York Times thing. You got to remember, Times is so liberal. The New York Times is a centrist paper that is the voice of big capital, finance capital, eastern capital, old money. Bush and the cowboys and the oil industries and the pharmaceuticals and all of that, the people that suck as much as you can out of people as quickly as you can, and the only thing that matters is the next quarterly report to the stockholders. Maximize return on investment. No matter how unstable it makes the economy, no matter how foreign imperial adventures erode the military and respect for the United States and the economic, and what they care about the most is economic investments around the world. Doesn't matter. Just get as much money as possible. Well, the old money, the old elites that the New York Times represents, they know that, you know, they're going to be around a long time. They've been around a long time. They've had the money a long time. They figure they're going to have it a long time more. So they have a more sensible approach, although the Times likes to kind of forget that it peddled a lot of the lies that brought us into the Iraq War. So you got to be careful. But it had, I think, the largest editorial that I've ever seen in the New York Times. And it was, it's one of those big papers like the Detroit News, Detroit Free Press, not a tabloid. And a full half page, vertically, was entitled The Road Home. And I'm just going to read about two sentences out of this. It's time for the United States to leave Iraq without any more delay than the Pentagon needs to organize an orderly exit. And you can call it a retreat, whatever you want to call it, a retreat, a defeat, whatever. They call it an orderly exit. Next sentence says, like many Americans, we have put off that conclusion, waiting for a sign that President Bush was seriously trying to dig the United States out of the disaster he created by invading Iraq without sufficient cause, in the face of global opposition, and without a plan to stabilize the country afterwards. And then they go down the list of everything that it's going to take, the fight against the terrorists, the question of bases.
Boy, that was quite the editorial.
The Civil War, the human crisis, and I'll tell you, it ain't going to be pretty. I mean, it's not going to be pretty staying there, and it's not going to be pretty when the U.S. leaves. But this is what Bushco, this vile racket, has created. The last sentence is, say, President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney have used demagoguery and fear to quell Americans' demand for an end to this war. They say withdrawing will create bloodshed and chaos and encourage terrorists. The New York Times says actually all of that has already happened, the result of this unnecessary invasion and the incompetent management of this war. The country faces a choice. We can go on allowing Mr. Bush to drag out this war without end or purpose, or we can insist that American troops are withdrawn as quickly and safely as we can manage, with as much effort as possible to stop the chaos from spreading. Now, I don't know what they're such a pack of psychos and liars, the Bush administration. It's kind of hard to figure out actually what they're all about. I mean, one of the things that it could be is that they just want to dump it on the next president, that they know it's going to be a Democrat. So just like Bush 1 dumped Somalia on Clinton, here's a little poison pill to begin your administration with in early 1993, Bush will figure, what the hell? And because, they've got a long-term strategy, too, I mean, politically. And they've already reshaped America negatively and for the benefit of the ultra wealthy at the expense
of the way
they
want it.
Yeah, and at the expense of the middle class and the working class. And they figure that they know that they're not going to have a real adventurous Democrat, like we were saying earlier, that's going to reverse all the Bush attack on the environment and wage standards and safety standards and that site I've mentioned before. Which, what's it called? 100,000 reasons. I think it's 1,000, called 1000reasons.org, which gives the list of Bush crimes that are way over 1,000 by now. Check it out.
I haven't checked that out.
I'm going to look it up as we're talking, make sure I'm giving the right one.
Sometimes when I read those things, I just get so angry. So I'll have to choose a moment after I've done yoga or something.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, Peter and Jolene. And let's go to John in Fenton. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, John. Peter, you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Hey, thank you, sir. Listen, I'm calling a long-time listener, like fourth time calling, and I'm a little confused. Maybe you can help me out here.
Sure.
I used to be a big believer. Big believer, backed you guys up on everything you said, but now I'm a little confused. I feel like it's not necessarily my government that's let me down, but I also feel like it's my radio host. I'm not sure what to say in this.
Clear it up for us. I don't know what you mean. I mean,
Well, I feel like no one's giving me a right answer. And I feel like all we're doing is complaining, and we're not standing to fight. Yeah, we might go march, but we're not doing anything to solve the problem.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure,
yeah.
What do you do personally to make
all I do, Jolene, is engage in conversation. That's about it.
Okay. All right. I was just curious.
Yeah.
All right. What party are you affiliated with?
Neither. I voted for Al Gore.
Okay.
In the last election.
All right. So what is it? What are you frustrated because you feel that I don't know that it's necessarily. I think this is kind of redirected or misdirected, maybe frustration. You're angry
let's
with.
Let's say redirected.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the deal is we're not giving you the answers because you know what? We're talk show hosts. We don't have all the answers to give you, and we are just as frustrated as you are. But you know that's what this is. This is an open forum for us to talk about things, but we're not solving your frustrations, and I think that's why you're frustrated.
Yeah, I'm frustrated because there's not a mass movement of resistance and opposition because we didn't. I'm no different than you. I mean, if someone said to me, what are you going to do tomorrow? Well, we could go out to the, if you live around the Ferndale area, you could go out to Nine Mile Road in Woodward, and there's this intrepid band of vigilers that, anywhere from, 15, 20 people are out there with signs saying end the war, impeach Bush.
Every Monday.
Every Monday, 4:45 to 5:45.
Mm-hmm.
But is it going to end the war? No. And everybody honks now. People used to, throw people the finger. Now everyone honks in support. In fact, the people have signs saying honk if you want to impeach Bush or honk if you want to, pardon me, end the war, but there's got to be more. There's got to be a movement that really can exercise power, and we haven't gotten to that point yet. Because these elites that run things, the racket running things in Washington, they're impervious to the wishes of the people. I mean, geez, Bush was defeated in 2000 when you voted for Al Gore in the popular vote. So you would have thought, well, maybe he ought to govern in a centrist manner, given that the majority of people did not want Bush to be the president in 2000. Instead, he immediately invoked this far right wing agenda and has kept on it the whole time. So these people have no respect, Bush and the rest of them, Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, have no respect for popular wishes, do not care in a lot of ways. They don't even care what their popularity ratings are that are in the toilet. I mean, they wish they were happier when they were 80% right after 9/11, the event that his
God, were they that high?
Yeah, I mean, that he allowed to occur by his inattentiveness.
Unbelievable.
They figure, what the hell? They'll just ride it out, unless they've got some terrible scheme in mind. All right, but we share, John. We share your frustration.
John, we're here for you.
Yes,
we are.
All right, thank you. Thank you, John. And what I mean by that is, Bush, I think it will come out finally when it doesn't matter in 20 or 30 years, that Bush and the rest of them knew an attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda was coming somewhere. Could have been overseas, could have been here. And they figured they were going to do everything they did as soon as it happened. So when they got messages in August saying Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, I forgot what the language
was. He's planning something big
in the United States, and soon they didn't do anything.
Right.
Because plan A, step one, was as soon as they do something, because that's why Rumsfeld wrote in his diary.
God, remember that guy?
That night, yeah. Remember Rumsfeld? Yeah. Do you know that he has been dating Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah.
No, I made that up.
You lie.
But they both disappeared. But Rumsfeld wrote in his notes something about.
He heard she was really good.
Can we hook up Saddam Hussein with this? Because they were that was part of their plan. They were going to take over Pipelinistan, or what do they call it? They call it
Afghanistan. Yeah,
but really, to get the kind of pipeline oil access, natural gas.
Is that pipeline finished?
They're still there. They've got all these horrible dictatorships there, like in Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and all that, that are our buddies, that are these horrible, repressive dictatorships.
Borat's country.
Borat's country. Indeed. Where are we here? All right. Let's take another call before we take our break. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jim in Ann Arbor. Jim, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
I've called once before. One thing quick I wanted to say that it's funny that you said like the recyclables and stuff like that and how the it's going to end the planet. It's going to kill the planet, right?
Yeah. Well, I said if
global
we
warming is going to kill the planet.
Even if there was no global warming, the amount of what we're producing for the productive apparatus, the consumption machine, and the waste that we produce, if it grows, if it spreads to the 6 billion people on this planet, it's going to sink the whole. It's not going to be hospitable for human life any longer. People always say it'll end life on the planet. Hey, there's a lot of little creatures with little, you know, feelers and
that have a very specific purpose.
Well, they don't care if we go. It'll just be they go, oh, what the hell? You
know?
Yeah. And there's a lot of really weird things on the bottom of the sea that also couldn't care less what the hell we do. Although we're managed to destroy the sea as well. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, that's my point. It's not going to kill the planet. The planet's going to go on for a long, long time. It's going to kill us.
There you go.
Right.
But other than that, it's interesting the things, other things you're talking about, like the leaders, basically, everything is going back. I'm a Teamster. Everything is going back to like pre-labor kind of movement.
Sure.
And the only thing that's different is that rich aren't being taxed like they used to be.
Right.
They're getting all kinds of breaks.
We should go back to the taxation of the last halfway decent Republican administration, which, I don't know, well, never mind. I'd forget that adjective. The last Republican administration that wasn't a total racket, which was the Eisenhower administration, where that over a certain level, your income was taxed 90%. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the CEOs are making like 50,000 times more than the average guy on the line or whatever. And that used to be when the big oil guy, he was only making like 30 times or something what the people were making.
Sometimes a little bit more than that, but still, yeah, there was some connection. People weren't making thousands of times more.
Right, and this latest thing with Delphi, it's kind of like they're taking people that are basically the middle class, you know, just middle class, and they're going to make them into the working poor.
Sure.
And that's a domino effect that's gonna go into the big three, and I'm a Teamster and I have a contract coming up, and they're talking about tiered wage scales, which would be new hires coming in making like 60-70% of what we make.
Well, here is the deal, Jim. What they talk about the free market. Well, the only thing that these rapacious capitalists and their representatives in Washington, this racket in Washington, want in the free market is our labor. Everything else, because their buddies in the Supreme Court just overthrew this almost 100-year law that allows collusion between in pricing, and the corporations get more welfare than one can even imagine. This whole Iraq war essentially has been welfare for the corporations.
Only kind of welfare that Republicans agree with.
Exactly. And what they want, though, is our labor to be on a free market. Now, your union and my union, what it does is to artificially raise the price of labor above the market value of it. Because, why they want to destroy our unions is that they will be able to reduce our wages considerably. Because not so much in my industry, but in yours and in manufacturing industries, they have to compete with people that are making a buck a day, right?
Well, right. Myself, they can't outsource my job. That's impossible. But it can't be done. But, like with technology today anyway, let's just talk about Jetsons or something. But the fact that you should have a living wage is like totally obscure to them. The CEO should make millions and millions of dollars, and the guy on the line, the guy doing the work, should make nothing. And like that the guy on the line is making the profit for the people that own the company.
Well, sure. In fact, if you got rid of these CEOs in general, set up committees of workers to run it all, it would be run just as well. I mean, there's any number of cooperative businesses that are competitive and do well. In fact, if you think about the state of Delphi, if you think about the state of GM and Chrysler and Ford, I guess these really, really wealthy guys with the $1,500 suits and $8,000 Rolexes and the $400 pair of shoes.
Oh, they're probably $20,000.
Yeah.
Rolex. Sorry.
Yeah, right. Well, they don't want to. I mean, they haven't done real well, have they? They ought to be fired and set up a committee of people that know a little about how the whole business operates. All right, Jim, I got to take a break. Thank you very much. We were, by the way, talking about this website. It is thousandreasons.org, and I looked at it, and it looks like a news site. But if you go, if you look at the top, it says reasons, and there is the reasons. I don't know, 1,000 reasons to impeach. Yeah, I guess I don't know if that's how it started.
Right.
But here's number one, and this goes way back. Actually,
and then
yeah.
You do need to take a break.
Yeah. This is EPA issues an arsenic and tap water standard higher than that recommended by the public health advocates. Well, I mean, to make a long story short, is the Bush administration, by executive order, has allowed more arsenic to be in water, and this is mostly out in the West, and this is to support his buddies in the mining industry. It doesn't affect us too much here in the Midwest. But what should be there? What should be happening in terms of a mass movement? It should be a mass movement of mothers that say, George W. Bush, you're poisoning our children as well as us. But this is one of 1,424 reasons to impeach Bush. We'll be right back.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with the big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. This is WRIF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. And joining me, Jalene Jordan, for our last segment. Hey, by the way, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, a couple of repeat, I probably shouldn't even say this. Sometimes people don't want
to. A couple of interviews.
Yeah,
what are they?
A couple of interviews. David Suzuki, the amazing environmental writer from Canada. A man, I think mid 70s, maybe older, talking about his memoirs.
Very timely.
Yes, one of my favorite interviews, Bill Morgan, who did a biography of the poet Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah,
nice, Peter.
Where is this? Okay. I'm always saying that Republicans don't pick up their dog crap.
Yes, I know you do.
Yeah. Well, A.E. writes in,
God.
Scooter's commutation brings to mind your often repeated statement that Republicans don't pick up their dog crap.
People do listen to us.
Here's a good example of dog crap they're leaving on our sidewalk.
Okay, right. There you go. Right. Nice one. Good one.
All right. Let's get this screen up. Whoa. You know what happened? You kind of have some. Are all you people as ADD as me? I mean, come on. You got to wait a few minutes.
I think everyone's a little ADD.
Yeah, on this bus. Yeah, so if...
No, I think in general.
there's a lot of stimuli.
Yes, yeah. There's too many.
There's too much.
Too much.
Anyway, so...
Read a book.
So you can... after the show.
After the show. Yeah, right.
But anyway, that leaves a lot of lines open for you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And let's go to this line. Here's Charlie in Lincoln Park. Charlie, welcome to the show.
How you doing, my friend?
Good.
Okay, there's two things. One, I am a career soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Three things I want. It just unbelievably admitted. One, we are founded on an absolute principle of revolution.
Right.
I mean, from the very start, our country was founded by men who saw a better way.
Right.
And decided to do it that way.
Right. Revolutionaries.
Exactly. I mean, across the board.
Okay. Number two.
Number two, unions are absolutely killing our ability to compete in a global market.
Well, you know what? Jolene just perked right up. To some extent...
Well, I was looking at you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to some extent, you're right. Because us wanting living wages, middle-class wages, as opposed to being like we were with our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, where we had to work 12 hours a day for a pittance, now that's been transferred to other places that can do the same labor, that now people in this country want to have decent work conditions, vacations, a good wage. So, man, we've got to pay people. So that's it. It's blackmail. The system blackmails you. They say if you want a job, you got to take a 40% wage cut.
Oh, okay. And that's fair if you're just looking at page one of a proposal. Page one has that. But now you also have to look at the fact that, okay, it's cheaper for a company like GM or Ford to build a factory in Mexico,
right,
from the ground up.
Well, yeah, well,
that's cheap.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So they've found a source of human labor. Imagine yourself, your family, your neighbors, your community, being the place where you have to like start all over again from industrial capitalism, like the 19th century, with child labor and no benefits and unsafe working conditions, a totally arbitrary employer, on and on and on like that. So that's what the people in Mexico and Indonesia and China and India, that's what they're all facing now. And then these employers here say, hey, if you don't let us give you the shaft, we're just going to send more of our business over there. Well, that means we're kind of screwed, right?
Absolutely not. If the American worker was willing to take a reasonable wage, see,
what's reasonable?
Jolene asked you a very important question.
What's a reasonable wage?
How do you determine that?
A janitor not getting paid $23 an hour to sweep a floor.
Do you know how hard janitors work? Do you know how hard those jobs are?
Do you know?
They deserve that.
It's about the Domino Patrol. And everybody who works in a factory right now is laughing because I said the Domino Patrol.
You know, somehow or other, Charlie, this must be ingrained in this anti-union rhetoric, because this is about the third time that people have brought up the idea that it's UAW, United Auto Workers, janitors that are the cause of all this. Not the mismanagement of the people at the top, but the janitor who, and we never think highly of the people that do this.
And we knew the janitors down at the Solidarity House. We saw how hard they were.
How many UAW janitors do you think GM employs?
I'd say at least, 5,000?
Come on, man.
Are we talking about Metro Detroit, or are we talking about GM?
I'm talking about GM. You think there's 5,000? Oh, I don't know. Maybe there is. Listen,
I have no
idea. One of the things that I would hope that any union would do would make sure that people don't have to bust their butt incredibly, so that you're working and working and working. That's 19th century.
To the point where you have no quality of life.
That's what hundreds of people died for in the 1930s, for the right to unionize, so that one's life wasn't dominated by harsh work and bad wages and unsafe working conditions and environmentally crappy workplaces and all of that. And you're like some 19th century guy, Charlie. Come on. Have some sympathy for the people. I mean, if you have to clean up other people's stuff, I mean, you deserve $23 an hour. And $23 an hour comes out to the grand total of $46,000 a year. Wow, man. Ain't that a princely
then
sum?
Then take your taxes out.
And then take your taxes out.
And so, everything else.
So for waking up at 4:45 and going, and believe me, you do work. If there are people, I mean, there's
that is physical, difficult work.
Yeah, and are there people scamming in union jobs? Very well, maybe. But you know what? People are scamming in non-union jobs as
We've
well.
We've been talking about scams for 2 hours in the government.
Yeah. What and what the hell do these CEOs do that can't keep a? I mean, why is it that these companies that are working like Delphi? When they were going into bankruptcy, the management was getting millions of dollars in bonuses.
And Kmart would be a great example of that. You have a company going into bankruptcy where a CEO was relieved of, again, being a soldier, I would say command, but relieved of their position and given a bonus to leave.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And blaming it on janitors really doesn't look at the whole nature of globalization, the nature of the auto industry. I mean, who's making the deals here? And it's not like a bunch of janitors walked in and said, look, dude, you're paying us all this money. These guys negotiated, even if they are making, quote, too much money or asking, quote, too high a salary. Who the hell signed the contract? It was these managers that are still walking away every year with tens of millions of dollars. Fire these CEOs, not the janitors, and let's give people a living wage.
And thank you for doing all of that work for us, janitors in this building.
All right. Thank you so much. Yeah, and as I always say, what would you be more upset about if janitors and garbage men went on strike or lawyers?
Ooh,
and investment bankers.
That's not a tough one.
Yeah, exactly. Who? Let me see if there is somebody here.
Yeah, you have a lot of calls.
Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Long time listener, back from '89. First time caller.
Wow. I don't have a name up here or where you're calling from. Who is it?
This is Tim from Taylor.
Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I don't know what that last caller was talking about. I don't know if he thinks the Fords are hurting for money or anything like that. But I basically wanted to go back to that caller, the Marine that had called a few calls back.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to expand a little bit on the career politicians and what type of fear they should throw into the heart of the average American. To me, these people, you know, they're completely bought out. They're completely in somebody's pocket. And anybody that's, you know, that's not the way any type of representation or any public office was meant to be, in, you know, from the beginning of this country. You know, they should all take an example from George Washington. You know, he did his job and stepped aside and, you know, left it to somebody else. And basically, I wanted people to more or less watch and not listen to these people. You have to see what they do, check up on them every day on their websites, on their policies, on what they're up to every day, and don't listen to a word out of their mouths because you're going to get nothing but lies.
Well, I think that's true. And also, if you really, if you have strong opinions in all of this, and I'm sure you're someone who checks a lot of websites where you can get information other than just the official government propaganda. If you go to sites like truthout.org or buzzflash.com or commondreams.org or counterpunch.org, you'll see assembled a much, much different picture of what's happening in this country and of the politicians of this country than you'll get by watching ABC or Fox or CNN or any of the rest of it. All right, I'm going to go through some of these calls a little quicker because we're getting towards the end of our program. Tim, please call us again and we'll spend a little more time then. Thank you very much. Let's see. Here is Steve is in Shelby Township. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hey, I've been listening to you and listening to all these people that have never had a union job. I've been in the union for about 10 years, and if it wasn't for the union, I wouldn't have a job. And some of these guys that have voted Republican and think that that we shouldn't be a union state or a right to work state are crazy.
Yeah.
Because the union, in behalf of our fathers and our forefathers, have a lot to do with the wages that are set for the people that are out there right now.
Sure. So even
that are making $20 an hour. I took a pay cut about 5 years ago, you know, just to keep my job and keep everything going on. I'm a die maker
mm-hmm.
that works in Warren. And a lot of these guys don't think that that if they ever get rid of the unions, that their wages are going to stay right where they are.
No, they're going to plummet. I mean, that's what part of the scheme is. That's what Bush is all about. That's what these corporations are all about. They want to destroy the wage standards that we have. And, you know, and this competitiveness is only partially true. They're using the globalization of production and labor as an excuse to drive down all of our wages.
And I feel the rant to rave because these people have switched everything over. My job and everything has gone overseas.
Yeah.
Okay. And I work maybe 6 months, maybe 8 months out of the year. And it doesn't matter if I work for a non-union shop. The non-union shop, if they don't like you, you know, I've been a victim of nepotism. I've been a victim of discrimination, okay, of what everybody, you know, it doesn't matter what I do. I go in and punch the clock every day on time, never missed any hours,
mm-hmm.
Never sick, never anything. And they would get rid of me because I would either speak my mind or I would come in there and I wasn't related to anybody.
There you go. That's nepotism. Yeah, we need our unions. All right. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. Here's Joe driving down I-96. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Good.
I was calling about these people who are talking about the union that's destroyed a lot of stuff. And I'm sorry. I don't agree with that at all. I think really it's a big business taking over the country. I mean, they're running the country basically. We're at their mercy. They're driving wages down, cost up. I mean, basically, you know what I mean? I worked at a company for 10 years. I was union over there since September 11 happened. Business went down. I ended up getting laid off back in October. They shut my plant down, and now I'm working for a non-union company. They charge us for stuff when we screw up.
Yeah, well, it's like I said, they want to ship us back to the 19th century. It's like the 20th century and the 1930s and 40s and 50s never happened. So.
And it started way before 9/11. It was was when Bush got into office.
Thank you, Joe. I'm going to hurry through a few calls now. Thank you for yours. Here's Bill in Toledo. Bill, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Say good morning. First time to call your show.
Welcome.
And I love the time that you're on because you helped me get over the hump until I can get a hold of Mike Malloy or Guy James or Randy
Mike
Rose.
Malloy's a good man.
Our buddy.
Yeah, all of them are. But you guys perform a great public service. And
I just want
to say what a great show you have. Also like to comment on what they said about union workers. I was with the United Transportation Union for 34 years. And that was one job they couldn't export.
Yeah, right.
Worked on the trains. So, but I want to say one thing about protests. And wonder why it is that we can't take over some of these radio stations, or maybe not yours.
No.
But some of these TV stations, like they do in Europe and France and, you know, Yugoslavia, wherever those guys get mad, the first place they go is the TV stations.
Well, Bill, you are...
Don't come here.
Well, you're in Toledo. Pardon me. You're in Toledo, which has a very vibrant protest movement. Bring it up to him. No, no, you shouldn't do it. Can't do it. Wrong, bad.
Go to D.C. There's a march.
September 29th.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll be there. All right. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for your call. I'm getting through these calls a little quicker than I normally do. We have any more time? Yeah, well, maybe one or two more. Bill from Westland, tell us quickly, please. You're on the air. Bill. Mike.
Yeah,
go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter.
Yeah, hi.
I would like to answer some of the questions for the caller who referred to the janitors, the UAW workers, making $23 an hour. I find it amusing that a person that is on the lower end of the economic scale attacking with animosity a fellow worker, and the source of this animosity is very clear. He's envious and jealous.
Well, sure. I've said any number of times before, this country is run on, what do I always call it, the party of resentment. Yeah. All right. Got to end the call. Good remark, but
yes.
I've got to. We got to get to our interview. Stay tuned. David Suzuki, the great Canadian environmentalist, very interesting person, perfect for a night following.
Live Earth.
Live Earth. Jalene Jordan,
or
thank
Earth
you so
Lives,
much.
As I've been calling it for days.
Thank you so much. And Bill
thank
Morgan,
you,
who's going to be talking about the Great American
Thank
Ball.
You, Al. Thank you, Jeremy, for doing the great work in the other room.
All right. Next week.
This is WRIM.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was. Like double cherry pie, yeah, there she was. Like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Hanging around downtown by myself, and I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was. In platform double suede, yeah, there she was. Like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and candy, yeah. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this show. I smell sex and candy, yeah. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, mama, this surely.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. What a pleasure to be with you, and what a great pleasure to welcome back someone who's been on the Peter Werby Show before. And he is a man that has spent his entire life being aware of the environment and then speaking on its behalf. It's David Suzuki, and David Suzuki is an acclaimed geneticist and environmentalist. You may remember him as the host of The Nature of Things with David Suzuki. He's the founder and chair of the David Suzuki Foundation. He's written more than 40 books, including The Sacred Balance and Tree. I think that may be the one we spoke with him about last. He co-authored that with Wayne Grady. He's been named a Companion of the Order of Canada, holds 18 honorary degrees from institutions in Canada, the United States, and Australia. And there's lots, lots more of the honors that David Suzuki has.
But you didn't mention that I lived in Leamington for 4 years, just across the river from Detroit.
I didn't know that. Is that in here?
Gee, it should be, yes. Well, maybe not, though. Maybe not.
David Suzuki is my guest. And tell me this. You've written, this is your second autobiography.
Well, I'm a bit embarrassed about that. I never intended to write an autobiography when I was 50. I mean, I felt I was far too young and stupid to write an autobiography. Well, now that I'm 70, I'm still stupid. But I actually submitted a book of essays when I was 50. And the editor kept saying, oh, no, 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 why don't you put more personal stuff? Don't write this stuff, this essay. And he kept kicking out the essays. And in the end, only three of the essays made the book, and it became an autobiography. But I felt that was far too premature. But once I got to be 70, you know, I figure most of your life is done, Suzuki. You're on the down slide now, and it's getting steep to the end. So maybe it's a point at this time to start reflecting back on that life.
Well, David Suzuki, you said, and I've always known you, and in through your writings the time we've talked, as a modest man, but when you described yourself as stupid, I think you probably meant something a lot deeper than one would take as just sort of...
Well, no, I just didn't feel wise the way that elders are supposed to be. I mean, I'm sure that as you get older, too, your brain is still feeling very young, and you're thinking, God, when my dad was this age, he was so old. But once you get to that age, you think, but I'm not that old, and I'm not that smart, you know, like... My dad was the source of all knowledge. If I got in a jam, I would go to him and get advice from him. But I realize now he was probably making it up the way I'm doing now that I'm 70. I mean, but I have got a few scars on my carcass and a few experiences that that may be worth passing on.
Well, I think so. There's lots of information, lots of observations, lots of tales. And David Suzuki, you've certainly told this story any number of times, but it bears repeating because it had such an impact on your life, and that's what happened to you at the outbreak of World War II, something we thought only happened to people of Japanese ancestry in the United States.
No, no, it happened in Canada as well. In fact, it was worse in Canada than in the United States. First of all, you had a large population of Japanese Americans in Hawaii, the very state that was bombed by the Japanese, but they weren't incarcerated. But the other thing was that at the end of the war, the Japanese Americans were allowed to go back wherever they wanted. But in British Columbia, at the end of the war, they said, look, you've got two choices. You can sign up, give up your citizenship. We'll give you a one-way ticket to Japan, or get out of the province and go east of the Rockies. So it's one of those terrible things that there were 22,000 Japanese on the west coast of British Columbia. Most of them were Canadians by being naturalized. They had come from Japan. But about 10 or 15% of them were, like my parents and my sisters and me, born and raised in Canada. But because, you know, we were at war with the Japanese, we looked different, and we were regarded as a threat to the country. So we were deprived of all rights of citizenship, incarcerated for the duration of the war, and then kicked out of the province. And for me, that's been a burden I've carried for the rest of my life. That is, I've got a job to remind Canadians and Americans that democracy sounds great. Democracy, you can promise, you know, equality before the law and freedom to associate and move and speak. Those rights and freedoms sound great, but the only time they matter are when times are tough. If you can't guarantee them when times are tough, then you don't deserve to be called a democracy. And I'm here to remind people that democracy failed in World War II. And now after 9/11, I see the same kinds of fears coming back, and people that may dress differently or speak differently, and now suddenly we're prepared to deprive them of all of the rights that we fight so hard to protect. And my reminder is, democracy is a fragile thing. You always got to work hard to live up to the ideals that we spout so readily.
Now, when you use the phrase internment camp, it brings up images of like Germany and what happened.
Well, I call them concentration camps. A lot of people get upset because they say, well, how dare you call them concentration camps? They're nothing like what the Jews had in Germany. But to me, the camps in Germany were death camps. They were a very different thing from what we were in. But we were in concentration camps in Canada. And they were, you know, I was a kid. So my parents shielded us from a lot of the difficulties and the fears and anger that they must have felt. But they suffered tremendously. But as a kid, I was roaming the hills, you know. We were in an area of the country that is now a provincial park, and it was just a beautiful place to bond with the natural world. For me, the terrible thing that happened in the war was that most of the kids in school that I went to with had parents that had come from Japan, so they were fluently bilingual, whereas I only spoke English, and because I didn't speak Japanese, they all picked on me and they'd beat me up. And so I didn't like the Japanese kids. And the problem was, when I looked in the mirror, that was the guy that my government was saying was the enemy. You know, we're the guys in planes crashing into decks of ships, and we were not to be trusted. So the result of that was this terrible, terrible self-hate or self-loathing that I felt towards myself. And to this day, I don't like to look at myself on television or in pictures. I was watching an old film with my wife the other night, and she said, David, do you realize every time you come on camera, you turn away and you don't look? And I didn't even realize how unconsciously I don't like to watch myself, and I kind of turn away. And then I think of Native Americans, and for 150, 200 years, they've been told by the Europeans that came here, you're savages, you've got nothing to teach us, you've got to become like us. Think of the self-loathing and hatred and the difficulty that they experience from their occupation.
Well, David Suzuki, as I said, you're a modest man, so this may embarrass you, but for radio listeners, where there's a number of photographs on the cover of David Suzuki's book, The Autobiography, and in my estimation, you're a handsome man, so start looking right at the camera.
Yeah. Well,
because,
thank you.
Well, this, of course, and as I said even before we got on the air, I had no idea what direction this was going to go in. David Suzuki is an environmentalist and done an enormous amount of important writing and television about the environment, but we're off on a tangent, but it all is relevant. And one more aspect of your early experiences and those of Japanese Canadians and Japanese Americans, here in the United States, eventually there was an apology and even reparations paid. Has Canada done anything like that?
Well, that's one of the ironies. It was Ronald Reagan that issued the apology and paid the people from the camps. And because Brian Mulroney, the Prime Minister of Canada, was such a good friend of Reagan, at least this is my interpretation, very soon after the United States issued the apology, Canada did the same and gave people from the camps 20,000, I think, as recompense.
Well, although there was a couple of bright spots in the Reagan administration, one wasn't when he referred to Prime Minister Mulroney as Prime Minister Muldoon, he said one time. But let's move to the environment. And although the life of David Suzuki is contained in the autobiography, I think it's worth exploring your view of what is happening right now. There is more and more frightening alarms being put out by people saying that the fisheries are going to collapse, that we've overshot our carrying capacity, that we would need another couple planets. Is it all as dire as we hear?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the tariff, you know, for me and even you at our age, you know, we can live out our lives without too much disruption in our lives. But, well, although it's coming much faster than I ever expected, but it's our children and grandchildren that are really going to feel the impact of what's going on. And I'll tell you, when the report came out about the collapse of the fish by the year 2048, my wife and I just sat and wept, because we're ocean people. We love the ocean. We have we have a place that we want to retire on an island, and yet we have been watching the collapse of fisheries in our area of British Columbia. The salmon runs that are going extinct. We used to always rely on going out and catching a rock cod or a ling cod to eat for dinner, and the government has just banned all fishing of ling cod now. There are no red snappers to catch, and rock cod, which we used to just pull out any time, there are so few that the government is saying you should catch or keep less than one, only one at the most a day, and we've stopped fishing for rock cod. There just aren't enough, and it's happening. But the total collapse of the oceans by the middle of this century, we just wept. You know, what is it? We wept in frustration. What is it going to take? You see, as a biologist, I think of ourselves as an evolutionary entity. Humans arrived on Earth about 150,000 years ago in Africa. And when you think of humans when we were born as a species, we weren't very impressive. I mean, we weren't very big. There weren't very many of us. We weren't strong or fast or gifted with vision or extra vision or hearing or smell. Compared to the other animals that were there in Africa at the time we arrived, we weren't very impressive. What the heck would give us an advantage to become the dominant animal on the planet? Well, of course, it was the human brain. And the human brain endowed us with this ability of abstraction. We invented an idea called the future. No other animal has a sense of a future as we do. And because we invented the idea of a future, the future doesn't exist. It's the only thing that exists is now. But because we invented a future, we are the only animal that realized we can affect the future by what we do today. If we look ahead, see where the dangers are, see where the opportunities lie, we can act today in a way that will give us a greater chance of survival. Forethought, looking ahead, was the great advantage humans had. And that, I believe, is what the definition of it, what it is to be human. We look ahead and weigh the opportunities and dangers and then act accordingly. And now we've got all of the increased brain power of scientists and computers and engineers and telecommunications that allow us to look ahead with much greater certainty. For over 40 years, the leading scientists have been telling us we are headed down the wrong path. We're on a very dangerous course. And now we're not paying attention. We're turning our backs on the very strategy that got us to where we are today. And we no longer pay attention. Look what happened. For over 20 years, the leading scientists in the United States have been saying New Orleans is a disaster waiting to happen. It's built right in a hurricane corridor. Half of the city is below sea level. This is crazy. And for over 10 years, they've been saying one day there's going to be a force 5 hurricane. And if you want to avoid the damage, this is what you've got to do. Nobody paid attention. Katrina happened, and look at the results. We need to look ahead. We need to listen to the people best able to give us an assessment, and that's scientists.
Sure.
And for over 40 years, they've been telling us, and we say, oh, well, we can't afford it. This will ruin the economy. My business will go broke. We listen to all of these other things, and we no longer pay attention to what scientists are saying.
Now, the pronoun we needs to be a little more precise, because I think that when the average person reads these predictions of ecological disaster, or at least of problems, let's say they're not even disaster, but of ecological problems, most of us know the importance of the environment, because it's our environment. It's the environment in which we live.
But
go ahead.
But if that's true, why is it that we don't raise it when elections happen? Why is it that we don't demand of everybody running for office that they deal with this issue. You say that we know that something is wrong, but I sure as hell don't see it reflected in the vast majority of people.
I think it's the we that are pretty powerless and atomized and scattered.
But you see, that I think becomes the reason why we are able to avoid dealing with this. We think, oh well, I'm insignificant. What difference does it make if I throw out this piece of garbage on the road, or what difference does it make if I take my car and drive five blocks instead of walking? And we think, well, everybody else is doing what, why should I do it? This challenge has got to be a collective. We've got to talk about we. We are all embedded in the biosphere together. And, you know, it's true. What you or I do in the global scheme of things is insignificant. But it's 6.7 billion insignificant people who are creating the problem. And 6.7 billion people are going to have to be part of the solution. And there are, the tragedy of our times is there are all kinds of groups pointing out the opportunities that lie in the crisis that we face. You know, Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado has written a book showing that the United States can get completely off dependence on oil, can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions massively, and there will be huge economic opportunities. All kinds of, you know, my foundation is pointing out that ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reaping economic benefits from it, ways of making the air cleaner and the water cleaner and our food cleaner and not destroying the economy. But the frustration is that this is not being taken seriously, and we elect people to office to lead us. Mr. Bush has been in office for 2 terms. The leading scientists of the United States, the National Academy of Sciences, has been saying for over 10 years that global warming caused by humans is happening, that we've got to take action. This is a threat far greater than the threat of terrorism. And Mr. Bush is denying the reality of climate change. He's not even doing anything to make sure that Americans get more out of every gallon of gas that we burn than we are today. What kind of leadership is this? What kind of vision is being shown by the leader of the most powerful country on the planet? I don't get it.
David Suzuki is my guest. He's the author of David Suzuki, the autobiography. It's available from Greystone Books. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. I didn't mean to say that I disagreed with anything. Certainly I don't with what
you just said. Understand.
What I'm getting at is that we become trapped within institutions and even worse, paradigms, and to burst out of it in advance of catastrophe really takes some doing, because if we're going to wait until there's, you know...
Well, I disagree with you that this is what the problem is. If you read the Bible, I'm not a Christian, but I've read parts of the Bible. You remember this guy named Joseph, who was the son of, I've forgotten what his name is, but Joseph was the beloved son of this guy who had married Leah and Rachel, his sisters, and he loved Joseph, and Joseph was so beautiful, and he was the envy of his brothers and sisters, and finally, you remember his dad gave him a coat of many colors, and the kid, his siblings are so jealous that they sold him to the Egyptians, and Joseph had this ability to read dreams, and the Pharaoh came to trust him, and Joseph said to the Pharaoh, listen, there's a famine coming, you know, and you better prepare for that, and to do that, start getting farmers to start storing wheat or grain. And they stored as much as they could, and 7 years of drought and famine, and because of Joseph's ability to look ahead and anticipate the famine, they were saved. Now, I believe that parable is the reason that parable is in there is to tell us about the importance of foresight. Look at Noah. You know, Noah's this carpenter, a voice comes out and suddenly says, Noah, start building an ark. And he's going, no, if I build an ark, my neighbors are going to make fun of me. What kind of crazy thing? And then God said, Noah, build that ark. There's a flood coming, and store animals 2 by 2. I mean, all of that is just a parable telling us that foresight, looking ahead and acting on that, is really important. It is what got us to where we are today. It's only very recently that we don't pay any more attention. We've got all these excuses, you know, we can't afford it. And, you know, The thing that frustrates me is this. When Pearl Harbor happened, the United States didn't say, oh, my God, the Japanese have destroyed the Pacific Fleet. Let's give them the Pacific. We can't afford to do anything. Of course not. Cranked up the economic engine, and look at what happened. When I was a senior in college in the fall of 1957 at Amherst College in Massachusetts, and I was electrified when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. Now, in the months that followed, and you're old enough to remember this, in the months that followed, the United States tried to match the Soviet feet, you know, and the rockets kept blowing up on the launch pad or got off the ground and blew up. And meanwhile, the Soviets announced the first dog in space, the first man in space, the first team in space, the first woman in space. And we realized, holy cow, the Russians are really advanced in science, math, and engineering. Did the United States say, well, I mean, they're too far advanced. We can't afford it. It's going to destroy the economy? Of course not. The United States said, we've got to win this one, and poured billions of dollars into the universities and scientists and research. And look at what happened. Not only did America beat the Russians to the moon, all of the unexpected spin-offs, you know, the satellite technology that gave us our cell phones and global communications, CNN, and all of that stuff came as a result of the American commitment to the space race. And this year, 50 years after the space race started, the United States won every single Nobel Prize in science. And that's because the U.S. stepped up to bat and took the challenge. I believe it's absolutely un-American for the President of the United States to say we can't do it or we won't do it. It's going to cost too much. It's un-American. The American spirit is to say this is the challenge. We've got the get up and go. We're going to beat this one and we're going to benefit from it. That's what it is to be in this country. And I find it astounding that Americans are able to let the President of the United States get away with this un-American approach to climate change.
Also, it's not like we can't do it. If you go to...
Of course not. That's why I wrote Good News for a Change. It's filled with examples of what people, governments, and organizations are already doing in many, many areas. The good news is there are lots of solutions out there. The bad news is our so-called leaders in government and corporations don't want to hear it. They don't want to make changes. They want to just keep doing it the same old way.
That's what I meant about being trapped within paradigms, but it has to be the people themselves. I'm sure you've seen that bumper sticker that says, if the people lead, the leaders will
follow.
I know when you go to your website, davidsuzuki.org, there's a little section there that says, take action.
Yep.
And there's any number of ways we can take action, and it may well fall to us, because if not one single, and I was, you know, when you said that, I was taken aback about how this wasn't on the political agenda at all during this big race. It wasn't anyone that ran on an environmental concern, a platform of environmental concern.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
And, you know, the guy that got me onto the need, you know, Margaret Mead said many years ago, don't despair that a small group of informed, committed people can bring about change. In fact, that's the only way change has happened. She's absolutely right. It is up to individuals, and we can make it a movement. And in 1989, I interviewed a young senator who was visiting Canada for a radio program, and he sent shivers up my back. I had never met a politician who understood the environmental crisis so clearly and knew what had to be done to get us out of the pickle that we were in. And at the end of the interview, by the way, his name was Al Gore. He was a senator from Tennessee then.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the interview, I said, Mr. Gore, what can journalists like me do to help politicians like you? And he changed my life. He said, don't look to politicians like me. He said, if you want to bring about change, you've got to convince the public there's a problem. You've got to show them that there are alternative ways of doing things, and you've got to get them to care enough to demand that something be done. And then he said, every politician will jump on the bandwagon. And he's absolutely right. And watching Al run for president, the environment was not on the agenda. And I'm convinced his handlers told him, oh, Americans don't care about the environment. Don't raise that. They'll just make fun of you. And I think that's a tragedy. Of course, now he's doing a magnificent job of, I think, of bringing climate change into the fore, because he knows very well what a threat this represents. But Al was absolutely right. Politicians are not going to do anything unless the public makes it an issue. That's why, did you know that in 1988, a man ran for president of the United States and said, if you vote for me, I will be an environmental president? Do you know what his name was?
Remind us.
George H.W. Bush.
There you go. Unfortunately.
And it wasn't because Bush gave a damn about the environment, because he didn't. It was because in 1988, the public had made the environment the number one issue.
Well, there it is, listeners. The challenge is for us. There's any number of environmental organizations. Start something of your own. Go to David Suzuki's site, davidsuzuki.org. We didn't even really get into the autobiography, but what you've heard throughout this last half hour is what has been informed by a life time of informing people and fighting for a planet that is not going to self-destruct. David Suzuki, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks so much, Peter. It's been a
pleasure. WRIF.com.
So we're from Jacksonville, Florida. There's another band from Jacksonville, Florida, which you guys might have heard of. They're called Lynyrd Skynyrd. You ever heard of them? Jason Todd over here playing the rebel flag. The song's called Simple Man.
Well, mama told me when I was young to sit beside me, my only son, and listen closely. What I say, and if you do this, it'll help you some sunny day. It will. Yeah, it will. Oh, take your time. Someone up above. So be a simple kind of man. Be something you love and understand. Better be a simple kind of man. If you can, if you can, if you can. Well, get your lost from the rich man's gold. All that you need now is in your soul, and you can do this, oh baby, if you try. All that I want from you, my son, is some peace. Give me a simple kind of man.
control?
We got your control right here.
And we congratulate you for that.
Join the Riprod panel online. You wanted to have a say in what 101 WRIF does and what music we play on the air? Now's your chance. It's your riff. You make the call.
This is a radio.
Join the Riprod panel online today at WRIF.com. Everything. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. What a pleasure to be with you, as usual. You know, I just spoke down at a class at Wayne State University, and the instructor was M.L. Liebler. Some of you may know him as one of the people that hosts a lot of poetry readings in Detroit. And I remember a poet one time, before he read, said, "Okay, lock the doors. We're going to do poetry." And I'm not sure why in some quarters poetry has gotten a bad name. Many of the people listening to this station, of course, listen to poetry every day. It's contained within rock and roll records. And poet laureate of rock and roll, Bob Dylan. So it's not so unusual, but somehow when it's just the spoken word in the form of poetry, some people shy away from it. On the other hand, there is a man, a giant in American poetry, whose life necessitated an enormous enormous biography of almost 700 pages. And joining me is the author of that. His name is Bill Morgan, and the book is called "I Celebrate Myself: The Somewhat Private Life of Allen Ginsberg." And we're reaching Bill Morgan in San Francisco. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show, Bill.
Hi, thank you, Peter.
I should say you've also written The Beat Generation in San Francisco and The Beat Generation in New York, other books as well, and pretty much of a companion volume is on Allen Ginsberg's most famous poem, Howl. And it's called Howl on Trial, The Battle for Free Expression. It's edited by you, Bill Morgan, and Nancy J. Peters. And I think many, many people, certainly in the audience, have heard of Allen Ginsberg, know his poem Howl. I last saw the City Lights edition, in which it first appeared, had sold a million copies, which is extraordinary. But it took you almost 700 pages, but a thumbnail sketch of Allen Ginsberg, if you would.
Wow. It would have to be a big thumbnail.
Yes.
Allen certainly spanned decades and touched so many people, especially through the 1950s and 60s into the 70s when he was at his most famous. But he was a poet born in New Jersey to a family of poets. His father was a poet, and when he went into poetry, he said he went into the family business. He became almost instantly famous with the publication of Howl and other poems when that book was seized by the police in San Francisco, and the publisher was charged with publishing obscenity. A famous trial resulted, and this took place 50 years ago. The trial proved that the book was not obscene because it had redeeming social value, and that set a precedent that allowed other books like Henry Miller's books and William Burroughs' books to be published in America. Allen went on from that. He became very involved in social and cultural ideas during the late 50s, 1960s, was a big leader of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and became very, very popular when I was a student in the 1960s as the leader of the counterculture and the youth rebellion, really, of the 60s and early 70s. So everyone my age grew up having a poster of Allen Ginsberg wearing his famous Uncle Sam hat on their wall in the dormitory. And from there on, Allen was established, wrote continually through his life, became a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a teacher at Brooklyn College, and also in Naropa, which is a Buddhist college in Boulder, Colorado. So his life spanned an awful long period, 70 years, and an adventure every year.
And the poem is Howl, H-O-W-L. Just sometimes I know these things get distorted over the air, but a million copies of a book, that's extraordinary. That outsells any of the bestsellers or most of them on the New York Times list. What do you see? Because it's in terms of its language and in terms of its imagery, it's odd compared to what most of us see on television or read in in the newspapers or an ordinary novel. In fact, it's, as they used to say in the 60s, it's a mind blower. What are, in Bill Morgan, in your estimation, what is its incredible attraction as a piece of literature?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind the times in which it was produced. Allen grew up during the 30s into the 40s, came through that World War II experience. People coming back from the war tended to want to be conservative, move into the house, have a family, children, get a job, a very conservative time capped by the McCarthy era. And Allen coming through that as a poet, as a homosexual, as a free thinker, wanted to write what he was on his mind, but it wasn't appropriate for every audience. So what he was writing about shocked everyone. They didn't think it was appropriate for poetry, in fact. The academic writers rebelled against Allen and said, you're bringing poetry into the bathroom, practically. You can't write these kinds of things. But Allen needed to release what was inside of his mind, and that was his big contribution to literature, was to start writing about the things that people talk about every day, you know, in a street language, not necessarily vulgar, but in a way that everyone could understand what he was talking about.
Well, street language, I mean, the imagery, though, is, like, extraordinary. I mean, just open to Howl and one of the lines, or one of the clauses in one of the lines, listening to the crack of doom on the hydrogen jukebox. That's and this is written before, or is it the hydrogen bomb, or maybe not, maybe that's what he's talking about.
That's right. That was a very influential on Allen and the other members of the Beat Generation at that time. The bomb was sort of hanging over them. It was the big threat at that time. Were we facing annihilation? Would we even live into this century? So that was something that was on his mind. So that is a reference to that. But it's a genius combination of words. No one had ever put the word hydrogen and jukebox together. And it just makes a fantastic image. That's what Allen was really, really good at. He could take words and put them into a new context that people hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, I was reading, where was it, some New York Times review of a book about Howell, and by Greil Marcus, where he talks about this photograph of these cadets at the Virginia Military Institute reading Howell. I mean, you would think that these straight-back, straight-laced military guys would be the last person in the world that would be reading a Howell for personal and sexual and political freedom. Yet there they are.
Right, right. Well, they have a wonderful teacher there, Gordon Ball, who took that picture, always introducing and challenging his students. Very similar to Allen, who was by far a wonderful teacher. And that's what he's doing in a lot of poetry. He's teaching, he's explaining, he's always helping young students understand something that they might not run into. But the picture at VMI, there's another picture that's not as well known of Allen talking to the generals. He's talking to the other people on the faculty, and they're dressed in their uniforms, and he's saying to them that I'm a warrior just as you're a warrior, but your war is not my war. His war was a war of love, and so he was trying to take that concept and teach them that there are other types of warriors than just a military warrior.
Bill Morgan's my guest on the Peter Werby Show. His biography of Allen Ginsberg is called I Celebrate Myself, The Somewhat Private Life of Allen Ginsberg, and an extraordinary little volume from City Lights Books. And City Lights is the publisher that originally published Howell, the controversial poem, 50 years ago. It's a 50-year anniversary of it this year. Howell on Trial, The Battle for Free Expression, which Bill edited along with Nancy J. Peters. Now, in his ability, well, let me actually start a little back further, because you mentioned Allen writing in the 40s and in the 50s. Now, that was the Beat Generation. This was a generation of artists and poets and writers that were pretty insular and for the large part ignored by American society. Yet Alan made the transition to the 1960s, where and you've written books on this, so I'm doing this off the top of my head. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. Most of the beats did not like the 60s, or many of them didn't, and didn't make the transition, or either didn't like the transition or didn't make the transition, where Alan Ginsberg just was in it fully.
That's right, yes. They were all individuals, so everyone reacted in a different way to what was happening in society. People like Jack Kerouac, who in fact was first married to a woman from Grosse Pointe.
Oh, that's right.
Edie Kerouac came from a family in Grosse Pointe, and Jack Kerouac was very conservative. Even though people think of his novels of these great adventures going on the road, crossing America, Jack was quite conservative, and he wrote about people who were not conservative, but he himself was. And he and Alan later, especially in the 60s, had quite a few disagreements over that. He backed the war effort and thought that we were right to be in Vietnam, whereas, of course, Alan didn't. Different ones of the writers reacted differently. But Alan was always a very liberal person, grew up in a liberal family. His values were always to challenge the government and their right to do things in our name.
Tell us, if you will, in this, I remember having read about this and looked this up just recently in your book, Bill Morgan, I Celebrate Myself, about the confrontation in Oakland, California, when the anti-war movement was going to go towards this base where munitions were being shipped out to Vietnam. I think it was 1965. And confronting them were the Hell's Angels. And it looked like there was going to, and plus the Alameda County Sheriffs and the Oakland cops. So these anti-war, particularly students and young people, were facing a formidable and potentially very violent group of adversaries. Tell us just, if you would, about Allen Ginsberg's intervention.
Right. Berkeley was really the center of the free speech movement at that time. And Allen was there to support their march, and they were heading towards an induction center in Oakland, California. They realized that the Hells Angels were quite conservative, were going to attack them and beat them, and they didn't have the confidence that the police would intercede and save them, because the police at that time were not sympathetic towards the anti-war movement. They did make a few attempts at a march and were turned back at the city line, but they came upon the idea that they would sit down with the Hells Angels and find out what kind of agreement they could make, if they had anything in common. And they actually did. They had a big party that Alan wrote a pretty famous poem of his about, First Party at Ken Kesey's with Hells Angels, it's called. And they sampled some drugs. They sampled a lot of beer and wine, which was the Hells Angels drug of choice. And so they found that they had a lot in common. And as it turned out, the Hells Angels resisted beating them up. They became friends with a number of them, and the march was held peacefully in the end.
And when you say drugs, actually, this was when they all took LSD, right?
This was LSD, yes. Yes.
And Allen Ginsberg was also, I don't know, you tell me what the connection was with who was the man who was called the LSD guru. And the most dangerous man in America by either Nixon or Hoover, Timothy Leary, who we just did a show on a little while ago.
That's right.
So
Alan met Timothy Leary when Leary was a very conservative professor at Harvard University. It was Leary's idea. He was teaching psychology, and he was experimenting with some of these drugs, these mind-altering drugs, to see if they could help mentally ill people, a very big concern of Alan's. It was Leary's idea to give the drugs to some artists and writers so that they could describe the effects of the drug, because his mentally ill patients couldn't describe what was happening to them. Well, big mistake, because he gave it to Alan, and Alan realized that this drug was too good to be kept to the scientists. And he convinced Leary to go public with it, and that turned into the whole psychedelic revolution. Alan's use of drugs, I should say, in Alan's case, was always a search, a spiritual search. He had had some visions early in life, like the saints of old had visions of God in many manifestations. And Alan wanted to had the visions and wanted to recreate those visionary experiences, and he sampled different drugs to see if he could get back to that moment of epiphany he had experienced. He found throughout his life that sometimes he could come close with a particular drug, but never duplicate it. And then he became interested in Tibetan Buddhist meditation, which I think got him the closest to those moments of enlightenment that he was looking for.
And you'll have to remind me, and I have to apologize, that I can't remember the name of the spiritual leader of the Diamond Jewelheart.
Jewelheart.
Yeah. In Ann Arbor.
Yes, it's Gelug Rinpoche.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And I remember a discussion on stage at one of the auditoriums. Oh, I don't know, 1995, 1996, where they were discussing what they thought the final moment one should have in their mind before death.
Oh, yes. Well, Alan died in 1997, and presiding over Alan's death was Gelug Rinpoche from the Jewelheart Sangha. He had trained Alan for the previous 10 years, instructing him on how to approach death, so that Alan, when he found out he had terminal cancer, wasn't frightened. He was looking forward to the adventure of going into another form of life. And it was the best thing that ever happened to Alan. He was able to deal with his death and the deaths of others with no fear, with complete calmness, and that's how he passed out of life.
My guest is Bill Morgan. His biography of Allen Ginsberg is called I Celebrate Myself. It's published by Viking, also a companion edition by a different publisher, though. Howell, On Trial, The Battle for Free Expression, City Lights Books, that which originally published Allen Ginsberg's famous poem, Howell. And you can go to citylights.com to check that one out. You can go, what do we say? Just allenginsberg.com, right?
.org.
.org.
Oop, oop, oop.
Right. Yeah, okay. And that's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, and Ginsberg, G-I-N-S-B-E-R-G. If you lose any of that, go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and there'll be links to all this. Well, let's go back to the smaller book, Howell on Trial. Howell is published. It has, it almost demeans it to say that it has socially redeeming value, that somehow, in the sense that it is such a powerful piece and such a look at American society, that to have to excuse it at all seems like an insult to this creative work. Yet it does have lines in it that I would hesitate to read on the air.
Oh, yeah, you wouldn't be allowed to.
Well, it doesn't. Well, at one point there's a bunch of asterisks in it, and is that with the famous F word? Where is that? Not in your book. Maybe it is in the other one. Oh yeah, with mother finally. And then there's I don't even get that. It's on page 26 of your book. With mother finally ************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************
his mother's mental illness. So that wasn't the offensive words that they were looking for, but there were others in there that were some of the seven terrible words that you're not allowed to say on the air.
Yeah. Actually, I'm looking at them right now. I won't say them. You're right. I like this career in radio. Okay, so this is 1956. It's still uptight, all white. And City Lights publishes it. The publisher, Lawrence Ferland Getty, a famous poet in his own right. And tell us the legal scenario. What happens?
Well, he published the book, and one evening, two plainclothes detectives walked into the bookstore in North Beach in San Francisco, and they bought a copy of the book, came back a few hours later, and arrested Ferland Getty and the bookstore manager for publishing obscene material. The ACLU bailed them out the next day, paid their bail, and it went to trial. Now, the trial found in favor of them after a lot of nationwide publicity.
Now, this was a jury trial, or?
This was not a jury trial. They waived their right of jury. But it was interesting for a couple of reasons. One was the judge that was selected had just become famous in San Francisco by sentencing two two girls he found who had been shoplifting. He found them guilty, and he sentenced them to see the movie The Ten Commandments. As their penalty, they were to write a report on what they learned from The Ten Commandments.
I would rather do the jail time, but go ahead, than have to see that. But go ahead. Go ahead.
But then the next trial that he was in charge of happened to be Howell, so they thought they were sunk. But he proved to be a very fair judge. He even went to the extent of reading Ulysses by James Joyce and all the surrounding, not just press, but the court had declared that obscene earlier. So he went through all of the legal papers on that before he issued a report that and said that it was not obscene because it had redeeming social value.
Ulysses had been declared not obscene.
It was originally obscene for about 10 years.
Yeah, but then yeah.
Yes, but he read the ruling that allowed them to publish that in this country.
Bill Morgan, tell us how you intersect with all this. You knew Allen Ginsberg.
I worked for Allen for the last 20 years of his life.
Oh, okay.
As his archivist and bibliographer, and edited some of his books, and lived around the corner from him in New York, so I saw him on a daily basis.
Well, famous people can be a royal pain in the butt. How did you find Allen Ginsberg?
All those things. He could be just like anyone else, which was the great thing about him. He was the person that people thought he was. He was so open, so honest, so generous. There was nothing hidden, and that's why I subtitled the book "The Somewhat Private Life of Allen Ginsberg," because he didn't have a private life. It was all public, and he admitted to everything, so he never had any skeletons in his closet. He was a wonderful person in that way. You knew who you were talking to. He wasn't saying anything behind your back that he wouldn't say to your face.
Did he like fame? Did he? At some point, I see that he actually had stage fright from time to time. He always looked so natural on stage when I saw him.
Right. Well, I guess that's just goes with any public appearances. You know, Laurence Olivier, I think, is one of the famous people who has terrible stage fright. But Allen did love fame. He loved what fame could do. He knew that as a famous person, people would listen to him and his ideas, and he could make a lot more impression on the world and influence a lot more people by being famous. And he was like anyone else, too. He loved famous people. He loved his friends Bob Dylan and Paul McCartney, and he thrived on the celebrity status that he enjoyed for most of his life.
I know, too, he sometimes used music. He played this little kind of, harmonium that made how you describe it, almost like accordion-like sounds when he would do some chanting poems. But also when he was at the Detroit Institute of Arts one time, he got two of my friends from a band called The Layabouts, a bassist and a guitarist, and had them accompany him while he did his poetry. So he actually enjoyed and was very sympathetic to rock and roll.
That's right. And he realized, too, that you could reach more people with music than the voice of the poet alone. So that someone like Bob Dylan is a wonderful poet, if you read their words, as well as being a great musician. I think the problem in Allen's case might have been that he really didn't have the voice for it. He had the bravery and the guts to get up and belt out a song, but he couldn't carry a tune, and that's what held him back from becoming a rock star, I'm sure.
I know Allen Ginsberg has been often called Whitman-esque after, why can't I think of his first name? Whitman.
Walt Whitman.
Thank you, Walt Whitman. And there's a poet who actually I haven't heard of in years, Antler, who's been called Ginsberg-esque. And I think sometimes younger people today think, gee, did everything great happen in the past? I mean, is it all gone? Is there, Bill Morgan, you still see a vibrant poetry scene that Allen Ginsberg, you think, would be happy with today?
Oh, yeah. Allen loved talking to younger poets. Antler is an example. Right in Michigan, you have David Cope, who was also one of Allen's favorite younger poets, and he teaches a college there. He's Andy Clausen. There's a whole list of younger people that have come up and become wonderful poets in themselves, and Allen was always encouraging them and encouraged by their poetry. I think that the whole hip-hop movement and things that are set to music but really are poetry are a tribute to Alan's influence on the spoken word.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Bill Morgan. The two books, and I'm going to let you mention the third as well. The big one, the biography of our subject of this conversation, I Celebrate Myself, The Somewhat Private Life of Allen Ginsberg, and that's published by Viking, Bill Morgan, the author. And also Howl on Trial, The Battle for Free Expression, H-O-W-L. If you've never read that poem, go read it. You can read it online, but or go out and get the City Lights edition. And that's edited by Bill and also by Nancy J. Peters. But also, you've just published a volume of his early poetry. Tell us.
Yeah, a third book, All This to Honor the 50th Anniversary. And it's Allen's journals from 1937 to 1952 when he was a boy. And it's called The Book of Martyrdom and Artifice. And that is the period of time when he met Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs and Neil Cassidy, all these people who 10 years later became the Beat Generation. So it's an interesting story.
All this has been really interesting, and the surface barely scratched. There's also the Beat Generation in San Francisco and the Beat Generation in New York by Bill Morgan. Maybe we can get him here to Detroit. He can do a thin volume on the Beat Generation in Detroit. Bill Morgan, thanks for being with me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.
From one end of the camp to the other.
Oh, my gosh.
Pick up that mic and announce the first tune.
101 FM, WRAF Detroit. My name is Alan Beck.